welcome everybody to the fourth energy stakeholders meeting. We started this stakeholders meeting in November last year, and very interestingly, the first one was on job, prospect of job creation in manufacturing in the renewable energy sector. I remember Professor Pandit, the DTI and the economic development sparks were flying about whether there are job prospects or not. And today, we are exploring solutions to challenges in financing and certification on locally purchasing renewable products. A very strong link with the first energy stakeholders meeting, which means, to me, there is some movement. Well, it's for us, as members of parliament, whom I welcome very much, and other stakeholders to listen from the captains of the renewable energy sector as to how far it's done. But of course, our topic today is clearly focuses to what are those challenges, where do they emanate, what's their character, and how do we look into that. But lineup today is that, as usual, so Department of Energy, I don't think it will always be like that. We may put you at the tail end sometimes. But the department at least must pave the way regarding this arena. And then we will have the SAREC, Southern African Renewable Energy Council. They'll take us through and trust and hope where, as they said, they include the developers who seem to be at this heat in these challenges. They'll articulate the current challenges and what efforts do they make to address the challenges and any prognosis they have. We'll then get the Bureau of Standards as well as the National Regulator for Commercial Specification addressing the rights as well as certification. I don't know whether they are going to be split, is it? And RCS on one side and SAPS on the other side. Oh, I almost lumped it together. Remember, I was from trade and industry. I know the evolution of NRCS, so I thought, okay, that's fine. You know better than me. But they can articulate what they see out of what the capital of the sector are saying. And of course, regarding financing, the Banking Association is around and very much welcome to indicate to us that what concerns we had. Remember, we are just about to start intensively Windows 3. Now, we really would like to see, you know, minimize during progress in Windows 1. And I'm sure all of us are keen to see the first what next year, sometime, whatever time, be generated, you know, from whichever wind turbine or solar panel. So this is just a humble contribution by this committee on behalf of the National Assembly and on behalf of Parliament to ensure that we facilitate a process, as I have said, that minimizes these improvements as much as is possible in this manner. Have you welcomed once again, everyone, and have said those introductory remarks. Shall I hand over now to the Department of Energy just to create the framework? Of course, as a policy department, they'll give us the policy legislative perspective on that. I trust everyone who will be talking will introduce himself or herself as a matter of practice. Over to you, ma'am.
My name is Mokhadi Modise, responsible for the green energy component. I will be taking you through the presentation. I must highlight even before I start that I didn't only concentrate on the the policy only. I tried to touch on some of the programs where different financing models have been, are used in the programs that the department is responsible for. The outline of the presentation, I will touch on the mandate, the mission and vision, and the energy situation in South Africa, the drivers and pressures in the sector, and the touch on the policies and regulatory framework, the challenges and successes, and access to financing solutions within the green or low carbon economy, and also highlight on how can we break the barriers through forging partnerships, and touch on those respective programs that I've just alluded to. Basically, the mandate of the department is to ensure and sustainable provision of energy for socio-economic development through provision of an enabling platform for other sectors to speed up economic growth, transformation, create decent jobs, and sustainable livelihoods, while unlocking of infrastructure investment through policy and regulatory framework, and also contributes to the MAPIC program to build economic and social infrastructure, implementation of various interventions to encourage sustainable energy resource management and use through flagship interventions such as solar, wind, various technologies, of course, and also get to improve efforts to meet the energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. With the mission and vision, the mission is to regulate and transform the sector for the provision of secure, sustainable, and affordable energy. We have got two visions, Vision 2014 and Vision 2025. A transformation and sustainable energy sector with universal access to modern energy carriers for all by 2014. While the Vision 2025 is to improve our energy mix by having 30% of clean energy by 2025. Even though you see the vision for 2025, I would still highlight on or touch on the long-term plan in terms of the integrated resource plan. The drivers and pressures in the energy sector within the country, you would acknowledge, and I hope that you are aware that as you address one, you indirectly touch on the other. You cannot disintegrate any of the drivers that are highlighted there. I would start by touching on energy security. We also need international cooperation, acknowledging that some of the countries are well advanced in some of these technologies. We can learn, from their experience and also use their experience as part of our learning curve. When you deal with our energy diversification or energy mix, on the other side, you're addressing climate change through implementation of the clean energy sources. Skills and capacity remains one of the pressures that we need to deal with within the sector. We cannot deal without it. Diversity of supply, you would note that we come from the coal dependency, and now we're talking about the mix that the chair has just touched on in terms of windows of opportunity, particularly the implementation of the independent power producers. Safety remains key within the sector. We have got the upward pressure on cost of energy. You would recall that we have extensive debates, more especially at the time when electricity price increase come into picture, not only electricity but other energy sources, including the liquid petroleum sector. We also have to deal with demand management in terms of our economic growth. As the economy grows, definitely that puts a trigger in terms of demand management as well as the integration of other sources. We also need to deal with the poor economic regulation in terms of the external factors. Like, for example, some of the things are unavoidable in terms of price increases. But as we do that, we need to think about affordability. Those who are in the high end of the income band may be able to afford, but the poor remains our concern in terms of how do we make sure that as we increase, but all of us, we kind of handle the burden in a more transparent as well as cautious way. Access to energy remains key. If you were to look at where we're coming from since 1994 to now, universal access is one of the priorities within the government objectives. And that forms, the drivers and pressures within the energy sector. If we were to touch on the energy policies and the regulatory framework, I only isolated those that speak directly to the renewable energy products. For the Energy Act of 2008, this is the primary legislative instrument that governs the evolution and transformation of the South African energy economy. It seeks to ensure that diverse energy resources are available in sustainable quantities and at affordable prices to the South African economy in support of economic growth and poverty alleviation. So this is one of the acts that gives us the edge to deal with the abundant resources that we have, but also taking into account issues of infrastructure development to make sure that as we implement the burden of capital infrastructure expenditure doesn't ultimately end up with the end user or the consumers. The second one, Electricity Regulation Act as amended. One of the objectives of this act is to promote the use of diverse energy sources and energy efficiency. The act has a provision for new generation capacity, and in this provision, the minister may, in consultation with the energy regulator, determine that new generation capacity is needed to ensure the continued interrupted supply of electricity and determine the types of energy sources from which electricity must be generated and the percentages of electricity that must be generated from such sources. You would recall that in the last year, we had new generation capacity regulations that were promulgated. It's in line with this Electricity Act that was immediately after the integrated resource plan. These processes are supported by the preferential procurement policy framework from the finance side in relation to the Public Finance Management Act. We do have the tax incentive regulations by National Treasury as well and the Industrial Policy Action Plan by the DCI respectively. We also went further. I mean, the discussions are getting intense in terms of addressing the or finalizing the independent system market operator bill. That I would guess that you are aware of where we come from in terms of this bill. The ISMO is intended to level the playing field between the producers and consumers of electricity in a manner that protects the smaller players from potential market abuse by the bigger players. The partnership led by the Economic Development Department through the National Economic Development Labour Advisory Council resulted in the signing of Green Economy Accord, Local Procurement Accord, and National Skills Development Accord. These accords are giving more impact in terms of framework where government is required to work with other stakeholders like private sector, civil society, and all those who are playing a key role within the sector, because we indeed acknowledge that government cannot do it alone. We all have a role to play for the success within the renewable energy sector. This clearly was a demonstration that, or the acknowledgement that government alone cannot do it. We need to work together to, in a more coordinated effort. Maybe I also need to highlight that South Africa has a relatively infant growing renewable energy industry. We are one of those who are emerging faster in terms of our plans dealing with the regulatory framework as well as trying to implement some of the programs to enforce what the regulatory framework is trying to address. And that includes, among others, approval of the renewable energy white paper. We had the biofuels industrial strategy. We have got the integrated resource plan and the new generation capacity regulation act that was promulgated last year. And in some of the legislative landscape, we're also introducing financial support to realize government's renewable energy policy. Like, for example, we have got the fiscal allocation as well as some of the legislation, like for Division of Revenue Act, where we're implementing the solar water heating through the MYPD. We do have challenges and successes in the sector, and we cannot talk about moving on without acknowledging those, because it may be a challenge to implement successfully if you're not acknowledging the shortfalls that are there. The major challenges remain the high capital costs and capacity building to deal with installation, maintenance, and development of local market and business. So that tells us that we need to work together in terms of addressing the whole value chain rather than looking at the end part. Government has so far created potential opportunities for skilling people and ensuring that they get absorbed into the energy sector market either through energy auditing and in particular the localization value chain, manufacturing, supply and maintenance of energy technologies. This was done by various stakeholders, government departments, business, civil society, academia, through scientific and technological research, education and training. However, continued support and proactive participation and partnership with various actors from business and all spheres of stakeholders is needed. Access to financing solutions towards green or low carbon economy, particularly for renewable projects. Responding to renewable energy market remains expensive and will require a comprehensive resource package. Hence, a multidisciplinary kind of approach is required by all stakeholders. South Africa will therefore have to commit to mobilizing the resources. Hence, today we are here to deal with how can we deal with the challenges in relation to financing of these renewable energy projects. This should include financial resources, technical cooperation, technology transfer at local, regional, and international levels. As a developing country, South Africa recognizes that international resources as envisaged under the United Nations Framework Climate Change Conference need to complement domestic resources to finance the cost of transition to a low and green economy. Further, government recognizes that improved finance policy coordination is critical to creating a sustainable climate finance architecture for South Africa. Like, for example, as the energy sector, we cannot only implement the energy policies without looking at our finance legislative environment. That plays a role when we bring other role players, like, for example, the donor, the potential donors or investors in the country. Breaking the barriers through forging partnerships, there is need for a multidisciplinary partnership, and we're looking at both national and provincial governments, academic institutions, community-based organizations, technology designers and manufacturers, donor governments, investors, microfinance institutions, development banks, small and medium enterprises. You could see that all these stakeholders, they play a key role in the sector. So we need a coordinated effort as well as a network of skills that are required for the successful implementation of the program itself. This partnership will ensure that our overall understanding of the challenges and solutions in the sector while addressing import tariffs and trade barriers through localization and mobilizing effective sales, distribution, supply chain, and all agents of change. We need to explore these challenges in depth. In this case, I wanted to touch on the financing model used for the independent power producers. I hope you are aware that the program was launched in August 2011 and the department negotiated with the DBSA, Development Bank of Southern Africa, in terms of funding black economic empowerment portions of the project. Of course, this was done through the Public Finance Management Act and the related or relevant legislation that empowers our development banks to work with government. It is acknowledged that some of the conditions might have changed, but they would be updated with time as required. The program requires projects that have already sourced funding from the respective banks. So, of course, the independent power producers, as they approach the bank, they need an enabling environment because the banks would start looking at the risks before they start lending the required amount. A letter of support must be provided by the concerned bank for each project submitted to the department. And the program requires developers that are ready in terms of, like, for example, availability of land, environmental impact assessment authorization, and a lack of support from the funding providers. And also, the funding part of it could be done in a form of mixed funding. Funding may come from international institutions. Local banks are expected to play a critical role in funding this project. And it should be noted that National Treasury does not accept any project indexed to a foreign currency. At the bid submission stage, project must be ready and have all the necessary funds to avoid not meeting the deadline as indicated in the bid document. It's not only the DPSA that is expected to play a role. We have got the IGC and PIC as well, who are also significant role players in the funding process. And in addition to this, there are a number of funding institutions with demonstrated interest to participate in such fund. So National Treasury is there to play a role in terms of making sure that all those who are key, in the value chain, are protected by making sure that they comply to our legislative requirements. I also touched on one of the programs that the department is running, where we have got a partnership with the German Financial Corporation on rural electrification. Specifically within the renewable energy sector, it addresses issues of, the program is on off-grid technology. And on this one, the program is funded, or the donor covers 80% of the funding, and municipalities contribute 20% in relation to the household rollout. And the program focuses on, we have got lighting, solar batteries, solar home systems, as well as base heating. There is one as well that at the moment we're dealing with in collaboration with the Department of Science and Technology. The program is called Global Alliance for Clean Cookstoves. You know, the areas that are not yet electrified, they depend more on firewood, and this is trying to address that because it's not only about cooking but also household health implications. On this one, the Alliance is planning to support 100 million homes to adopt clean and efficient stoves and fuels by 2020 and works with public, private, non-profit partners to help overcome the market barriers that currently impede the production, deployment, adoption and use of clean cookstoves in the developing world. The target that is here is the world target, is not only on South Africa. We still yet to determine our country target in relation to this alliance. And some of the programs where different models have been used as well would appear on websites that are there. On the renewable energy market transformation, this program is more like a grant program which addresses some of the issues at an early stage. You would recall that some of the potential developers struggle even in raising money relating to the pre-feasibility or feasibility studies, which form the base in terms of the banks lending them money. So if you don't have those documents in the initial stage, you wouldn't be considered. So the Renewable Energy Market Transformation Program is trying to address those challenges at an early stage. And with the program, we have got a partnership with World Bank. The Energy and Environment Partnership is a grant as well, which focuses on 8 countries, and South Africa is one of those 8 countries within the East and Southern African countries. So the other countries that are participating in the Energy and Environment Program, which is funded by the Finland and Austrian government, we have got Botswana, Kenya, Mozambique, Namibia, Swaziland, South Africa, Tanzania, and Zambia, and Seychelles has just come in to be part of the program as it's aligned. Maybe I just need to indicate that the Energy and Environment Program operates from regional coordination offices hosted by DPSA agencies units and receives advisory, technical, and administrative support from DPSA. This one is more 100% grant. It's not a combination of a donor as well as contributions from the beneficiary. And we have got various funding mechanisms in terms of the climate financing part of it in relation to the Copenhagen Accord. In 2009, there was a decision taken to start with the fast track funding for 30 billion by 2012, and we had the long-term funding arrangement of 100 billion US dollars per year by 2020. And on this one, South Africa has already started participating on the fast track financing of in relation to the 30 billion US dollars by 2012. And through this one, we have started engaging with the Danish Energy Management, the Denmark government, on some of the renewable energy projects. And the program is expected to start by 2013 once the implementation agreement has been signed. So we're talking about a range of 50 million pounds in the currency, the Danish currency. The Cancun Agreement was to establish a Green Climate Fund, financing sending committee, and establishment of technology mechanism under the guidance of COP. And I think some of the countries have already started taking steps towards that. Hence, you see Denmark has already allocated, some money to our country and other developing countries as well. Then I would touch on the South African Renewable Energy Initiative, SARI. We're coming a long way in terms of where SARI was. This was under the leadership of the Department of Trade and Industry, and it was handed over to the Department of Energy formally in around April, May, and that has just been concluded. And at the time when the program was handed over, it was way, after the budget planning process has already, concluded. Like on this one, I need to confirm that National Treasury has extensively progressed in terms of coming up with the funding model before the money would start running into the country. But several countries have already signed up. At COP, we had Norway, Denmark, Germany, and the European Investment Bank signed with the country through the Department of Energy, and several of potential partners we are engaging with them, like Switzerland, we have been engaging with US as well, and several are coming on board. But like once the financial model has been finalized by National Treasury, we would definitely share that funding model on how it would work to control or to manage the influx of several funds that would be coming into the country. This is just to show what SARI is trying to achieve in terms of various sectors. It would be catalyzing green growth in South Africa with minimal burden to the end user, of course, and it requires or it seeks to commit to an ambitious renewable procurement backed by modest domestic funding. So in this case, we're comparing various international models and contextualizing that to our own situation in the country, because it's not possible to cut and paste, and we also need to make sure that legislatively all of those comply with our own legislation in the country. The reason why I'm saying that it has to take up for different categories, look at the poor as well, in terms of our own context. So cut and paste is not possible. We need to do a lot of research in terms of which one is possible and where is not possible. How do we contextualize that to our own situation in South Africa? And this shows what SARI is trying to balance the scale in terms of the benefits and the costs. Within the benefit side, it would be addressing localization and job creation, greening of electricity supply, medium-term energy security, catalyzing green economy or green growth. And with this, it tries to align itself with the national, our new growth path. We've got climate change legislation, we've got energy issues, we've got issues of industrialization. So within the benefit side, it tries to address that. From the cost perspective, it addresses issues of cost in relation to technology, capital costs, as well as costs of accelerating deployment, because as we roll out in a massive scale, it requires financial resources, it requires skills development, a whole lot of things that need to be taken into account. So if the two are not balanced in terms of cost-benefit analysis, we may end up having a challenge, hence this kind of an initiative. And basically, these are some of the learning models that we are trying to look at in terms of what would help. We currently looking at, I mean, partial risk guarantees, policy insurance and guarantees, carbon finance facilities, grants and continent grants, loan softening programs, foreign exchange liquidity facility, export credit guarantees, pay for performance guarantees. So there is a whole lot of models that we're looking at in terms of finalizing the salary funding model. So I wouldn't dwell into each one of those, but they are more or less self-explanatory. And basically that would be the end of my presentation, and I wanted like the committee to look, I mean, to know the existing programs on financing renewable projects and the level of partnership that is required within the sector. And thanks.
Thanks very much. I guess today, not addressing the portfolio committee only, it's a bigger task. But really, without wasting any time, let's invite Salk to take the floor, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament and colleagues. My name is Johan van den Berg. I'm the Interim Chairman of the South African Renewable Energy Council. And SARIC consists presently of industry associations for solar PV, solar thermal, and then the Sustainable Energy Society of Southern Africa sector. And it's envisioned that in time other role players will also become part of this initiative. In order to use the time as best we can, I'm going to concentrate on the most important aspect because the printout of our presentation is available to people. So in summary, we fully support the localization drive and the Green Economy Accord. We were there when it was agreed. We in fact came out of the Green Economy Accord as SARIC. So we think that South Africans need to work together, public and private, and that will enable us to be successful. We think that if we take the right steps now, we will see the good results within 2 to 3 years, and it will be for us with us for many, many years to come. And then we'd like to flag that skills development is a very important aspect to us, but we're not discussing that today because the subject is slightly narrower than that. If we just look at briefly at what the status quo is, then I have highlighted there what is for the various technologies, and you will see that in solar PV it was 35% in round 1 and 2, and then went up to, and then in 40% in round 2, those were reached, and in round 3 it will be going up and will become slightly more complex, but it will be more higher. So the thermal with storage was 25% in round 1 and in round 2, and it will go up to about 40%, although again slightly more complex as calculated. And so the thermal without storage was a little bit lower. So the thermal also so far reached the threshold. Then in wind in round 1 and 2, the threshold was 25% for the first round. And that was achieved also, mostly because of the civil works and the balance plant that was South African source. And in round 3, the target will be higher, and it will imply either a South African tower or a South African base, and we will have to see what success the developers will have with achieving the specific target. And I'll talk a little bit more about that just now. I asked the various associations to just also tell us what it is that they specifically doing. And what you will see without going too much into the detail is that each of the SAPIA, Stella, and SAWEA, the three industry associations for solar PV, solar thermal, and for wind, have commissioned studies of various kinds in order to establish a localization roadmap. The first two associations are doing that with TTI, and one of them is doing it also with support from the German Development Agency, GIZ. Whereas in the case of the South African Wind Energy Association, we're doing that with the Department of Science and Technology. And those studies all have the ambition to find out how we should be doing this in order to optimize the benefits for the country. Sorry, going the wrong way. So way I also co-hosted with IDC a localization in Java in June 2012, and we also were involved in discussions between IDC and DTI to try and identify the blockages to the subject we're discussing today. And then CESA is also doing good work with government. I'm working with DST and CESA to build a platform that will enable the monitoring, measuring, and reporting on actual job creation, enterprise development, and skill development growth in the renewable energy sector. Also working with municipalities in that regard. Who is CESA? CESA is the Sustainable Energy Society of Southern Africa, who is also one of the members of SAREC. Okay. An important point that I will return to later on is that a certain long-term vision is required, and in polling our constituents, this is a message that came through very consistently, is that we need to get a roll-out vision. You know? So we've got the integrated resource plan, and that's a wonderful document with a very green slant and a 2030 time horizon, and that's fantastic. But at the moment, what's certain is the minister's first determination of 3,225 megawatts. And for some of the technologies, that may actually run out now in the third procurement round, which is presently still scheduled for 1 October. So beyond that, we know government has very positive intention, but if there's a foreign manufacturer who's not sure whether he should come to South Africa and set up a manufacturing plant, that entity is still a little bit unsure and hasn't quite made up its mind about whether there's enough certainty to come and build a factory. And it appears, you know, I mean, the studies we spoke about previously will tell us more certainly, but we think it probably takes 6 or 7 years to pay off a factory, and therefore these people require some sort of visibility to the sort of 2020, the medium-term time frame. So we think that there should be a certain allocation towards the various technologies. And what that implies, if I can just go back, why isn't that the RFP isn't cast in stone? For a very good reason, and that's that government probably says to itself that if a wonder technology comes along next year, there must be the flexibility to switch to that. And that makes very good sense. What we're saying is perhaps we should, and for that reason the RFP is revisited every 2 years. That also creates a level of uncertainty. So we're saying maybe we can have an IRP that changes, but for medium term only between certain limits, and that limit must be the one that gives the manufacturer the certainty to come to the country. So there was an ambition at one point to try and quantify this. I think on second reflection we realized that those studies will actually tell us what those levels are, and it might be premature at this stage to suggest exact figures, but I will also suggest later on that there need to be closer collaboration with government and with all those players, and within that forum, these figures can also be further discovered. Then I want to show you a picture which looks a little bit like a spider web, and if I succeed only in making it look complex, then I have reached my goal today. This is a project finance structure, and I want to spend a little bit of time just talking about this. The financing that the citizens of the country we are involved with every day is one where we want to extend our housing or something like that, buy a new car. And in each case, we practically sign surety for that. And we are on the line, and if we don't pay it back, it's going to come after us. And it gets the security because there's an entity that has signed surety effectively for that debt. The renewable energy and the program we're speaking about today, as far as I know, exclusively takes place on a project finance basis. So if one looks in the middle of the picture where it says project company, then that'll be a new entity that is erected specifically for the purpose of owning one asset, and that'll be the energy plant, whether it be whatever technology, and will own that for 20 years. It'll have no other interest, no other ownership, no other reason for existing. And it will have no big assets against which the bank can execute if for some reason the loans aren't being repaid. And on day one, that entity is completely empty and it has nothing in it. Around that are all the entities that we would see. And that is anyone from the equipment supplier, supplying, for instance, a turbine or a solar panel, to the person doing the maintenance for a 20-year period, and so on. the person who guarantees the resource. In other words, who says, I measured the wind or I measured the solar irradiation, and I tell you that if you put this piece of equipment in there, you will get so many megawatts per year out of that, megawatt hours out of that. So the security of the bank in a case like this lies in the fact that behind each one of these entities is a strong balance sheet. So that the bank sues one of these entities, potentially it can recover the full amount of the loan from any of these entities that might be defaulting on their guarantees that they're giving. And that's really important, and I'll get back to that just in slides that follow. So the people who develop the developer don't guarantee that to the bank that the performance of the specific entity. They put in their equity, and that's how much they can lose. For this reason, each piece of equipment must be certified and guaranteed by a financially strong company. Otherwise, there's a weak link in the financing structure. And Chair, while I'm not a banker, and I don't think what happens is that we put our money in the bank, they take that and run away to go and finance a renewable energy plant with that 10 rand that I put into the bank, effectively the health of the banks is at risk. So they have to be very careful how they finance these very large projects where one project can cost 2 billion rand, for instance, and maybe 70% of the money can come from the bank. And if they lose that money, our banks will be at risk, and our money ultimately is in the bank. So it's in everybody's interest that they should do this in a very responsible manner. The bank does require certification, and they require guarantees. And certification means that some entity that knows that technology with an international reputation comes and says, I guarantee that this, I certify that this piece of equipment has worked for a certain amount of time and has performed as follows. And then the guarantee is really saying, if it doesn't perform, I will pay, and I've got the money to pay. There are other ways to finance renewable energy projects. It doesn't have to be project finance, although project finance is extremely usual. One could have the IDC look, for instance, at providing no recourse finance, so they would take the risk essentially on the equipment. Or, something that probably wouldn't work, but it's a notional possibility, to say to the developer, well, don't go to the bank, just put in all your own money. So if it's a 2 billion project, don't loan the 1.4 billion, put in 2 billion of your own money. That will be very difficult for developers to do, and they would charge more because they would charge, the return they want on their money is higher than the bank charges to lend money. So effectively the cost of energy would go up. So if one then goes back to the specific technologies and one says, what are the certification and guarantee issues that arise? Then the PV industry says that there are currently 3 module assembly plants in South Africa with capacity of 120 megawatts per year. And there are further ones under development. And the PV industry says they are confident that at least the manufacturing of certain components can take place in an affordable manner in South Africa. On solar thermal, I've listed there the elements that can already be done locally and the ones that can't. Again, you know, for the big elements like the turbines not being made in South Africa, if an international manufacturer comes to South Africa today, that would be okay because they would bring their certification with them. But if it's a South African entity setting up shop immediately, then that would be an unknown quantity, an unproven quantity, and the guys who certify this would take 12 or 18 months before they're comfortable, and that would effectively mean that 12 or 18 months before the bank will accept it. One finds some of the same issues happening in wind, and if I can just say that at present, if a wind developer wants to put in a local turbine, that's not possible because there isn't a local manufacturer to buy from, and there's not a certified and guaranteed local blade manufacturer to buy from. Now, the third bullet point I want to qualify a little bit, I think my content is not quite correct. There is also present today, there's one local turbine assembler and blade manufacturer in Cape Town and in South Africa, and at present they are having difficulties because they don't have the guarantee behind them that we spoke about, and therefore the developers are finding it difficult to convince the banks to lay money against that specific piece of equipment. I know that they are trying to resolve that with new Shell and so on. And otherwise, the issue is much the same as I just said in solar thermal. It'll take time to get the certification thing going unless it's an international player. That brings us to solutions, Chair, and perhaps the essence of what we want to say. We don't just want to say what's difficult, we want to say how we can improve it. So I don't have a lot of time, I'm going to go through it a little bit quickly, but the one is the present, the procurement system talks about a 70-30 scoring for price and socioeconomic factors, and the member sitting opposite from me at the last session said maybe we should change that, and I'm again saying, well, maybe we should reconsider that. Even if we pay a little bit more, isn't it cheaper in the ultimate analysis if we have more people working, if we keep the money in the country and so on? If we can get international manufacturers to come here with their certification, there's a whole time lag problem of waiting for certification goes away. So that's something we should certainly try to do. And I am aware that the IDC and others, and the IDC for sure is working on that already. Third suggestion, I've already mentioned that institutions like the IDC and the DBSA that have a development perspective on this, they can choose to take risk on South African technology, even if it's not for everything they need, but maybe 10 or 20% of their portfolio in order to build local manufacturers. Then slightly more innovative solution, and that is that the bid rules can be amended to allow people to bid at different levels of localization and different prices. So for instance, you could bid at a 3% localization level and a certain price, and at a 40 or a 50% localization level and a certain price. And government would then be able to see what it cost. This would be costed very clearly because you see it at the different levels, and government would then allocate the bids at both levels and get a blended thing in the middle that blends local content and price in a satisfactory manner. And that would mean really that the industry is asked to achieve the target at an industry level rather than the product level, which is what happens in some other industries. Then the regional potential should be assessed. In Southern Africa, South African manufacturers will have a competitive advantage because we're close, and therefore we have to talk to our neighbors and make sure that we do this in a collaborative manner. We think that training and research and development should be promoted because there's also an intellectual component to manufacturing and becoming a renewable energy player in the world, and that is what this will do. We think we should definitely look at the off-grid and the self-generation options because especially in PV, this is where you don't need a project finance and you don't need to go through a very complex financing structure, and therefore there's bigger potential to do local content quickly in this specific field. And we think we should all work together because it's not one entity that holds the key to this. And we should unify South Africa incorporated in order to become a big player in renewable energy. So my second last slide is this one about what I call the collaborative role division. Make it a little bit small for everybody to read. But essentially it refers back to the issues I've just discussed, the solutions I've just discussed, and it in each instance it says who has a role to play. What I can maybe flag is the very first one talks about the vision about the role of RRP, and that's really something that our government can do. We can hope that it happens, and we can certainly promote the idea, but eventually that's a government function, and as the minister did say at the British conference recently, the government is looking at that, so we hope that it's quite close now. Then, just maybe on a very positive note, if the IRP happens more or less as we think, then 2015, and this is a little bit of guesswork in here, but it's intelligent guesswork, we think that by 2015, I didn't have stats for solar thermal, but in solar PV and wind, that's where South Africa will be in the global picking order. So maybe about 10th in solar PV, maybe about 15th in wind. From a very low base, so it means we would have moved at that very, very quickly, and as the IRP rolls out beyond 2015, we will again go up that list even further. And that is it. Thank you very much, Chair and members.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Beck. Dear Oksana. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members of Parliament, good evening. My name is Sadhvir Bassoon and I'm the Executive for Standards at the South African Bureau of Standards. give you an overview of the presentation. I'll try and be as brief as possible in terms of the overview. We have two operating divisions, standards and conformity assessments. I'll go briefly into those two divisions. We'll talk about current certification processes, both management and systems, management system certification, as well as product certification systems that we currently offer, current experiences and challenges. So the NABS is basically a founding member of the International Organization for Standardization, and we were established in 1945, so we're 67 years young. Historically, if you look at the prior to 2008, the NABS had regulatory functions. Promulgation of the new Act in 2008 had a divorce between the regulatory function, which now is an entity referred to as the National Regulator for Compulsory Specifications. So as of 2008, the SAABS is mandated to do three basic requirements. One is to develop, promote, and maintain a catalogue of South African national standards, to promote quality of products and services, and lastly, to render conformity assessment services. Just to give an overview of the technical infrastructure of South Africa, I think it's important to note that this SAABS is not the only role player in the technical infrastructure. SAABS is sitting with four other entities as well, including NRCS, the MISA, and SUNS. And it's very important that if we have a good, sound, active, proactive technical infrastructure in any economy, it has shown that it will certainly start producing the quality of products and services that is required for an efficient functioning of the economy. So all four entities basically report to the Department of Trade and Industry. NRCS basically administers regulations to ensure compliance and protection of human health and safety. The second entity is in the MISA. They underpin the testing and calibration through measurement accuracy and measurement traceability. And lastly, SANAS, they basically provide the formal recognition of entities that carry out specific tasks. So as an example, SANAS will come into the SABS and certify or accredit the ABS to become certification body, understanding that we are recognized having the competencies, infrastructure, and resources to perform the functions that we should be performing. Just on the standards division, the standards division is basically at the NABS, we are members of two international organizations, the International Organization for Standardization, ISO, and the International Electrotechnical Commission, IEC. We participate phenomenally and proactively in both these technical committees, have a very active presence in the international arena in terms of developing or influencing the development of international standards, and we mirror the international committees in our local committees in South Africa. We have local committees, approximately 400 national committees, technical committees, and subcommittees. The members in the committees are about 4,000 members, experts in their own right, from a wide variety of entities, including government representatives, majority of which are industry representatives, to an extent academia, and consultants as well. Try as far as possible to make sure that we have industry associations in the technical committees as the primary participants now in the committees. We publish in the region of about 500 South African national standards a year, and currently we have a collection of in excess of 7,000 South African national standards. The majority of the work is currently done at the head office of Pretoria, and just to reiterate, very important to understand that these national standards are developed by technical expertise. The SABS provides the technical expertise to write these standards. The content is put together by the technical expertise. Just a little bit about the conformity assessment that the SAABS provides. It's certification services, testing services, as well as training services. Included under certification is product certification. It's a process of administering the SAABS mark scheme, and I'll talk a bit about the SAABS mark scheme. And we have system certification as well. So those of you who have experience on management systems like ISO 9000, ISO 14000. This is basically what we do in terms of system certification, but a wealth of management systems in access to that. These are basically the SABS logos for the various system certifications. So if an organization or a company is eligible to register and meet the requirements of these various standards, they have the ability to put these logos on, not necessarily products, but on marketing material in terms of system certification and promote these. The SABS mark of approval is product certification. So products that manufacturers, suppliers of manufacturers would want the SABS recognition for will be tested by the SABS as well as system certification done to ensure that they comply with process controls as well as requirements in the specifications. And this allows the manufacturer to use the SABS mark of approval on the product. Just briefly on the certification process, system certification. Inquiry results in a promotional visit by the relative expertise of the auditor, which results in quotation of the certification scheme. Upon acceptance of the quotation, it's two-stage audit, general paperwork, and the fully-fledged stage one, and the stage two, which is a fully-fledged audit on the management system, depending on what management system is required or is requested by the entity. COA stands for clearance of findings, which is terminology to ensure that they meet all the requirements, and registration thereafter. So as an example, if an organization has applied for recently adopted ISO standard, which is ISO 40000, Energy Management System Standard, these are the steps that will have to be followed by the entity to ensure that they meet all the requirements and SABS has the ability, and SABS certifies them according to the requirements of the standard. Once they've been certified, certification allows for a period of 3 years, and within that 3 years, there is surveillance audits that take place to ensure that the manufacturer or the entity still complies with the requirements thereof. Product certification is somewhat different. It's basically a process whereby it's a means of ensuring that the product provides assurance in the marketplace and the product complies to a standard. So it's a dual process. One is to audit the system. It may not necessarily be a quality management system or ISO 9000 quality management system, but you've got to have process controls in place. And the product needs to comply with the requirements of the standard. It's a huge marketing tool, having the SABS mark on the product. It also, you know, increases the point of sale impact on various products, and certainly synonymous with quality, reliability, independently, dependability, clearly stating that SABS has the authority to ensure that at any given time that product complies to the necessary standard by doing surveillance audits and surveillance sampling during the course of certification. Just on the certification process itself for product certification, inquiry promotion quotation, on-site assessment, which I mentioned, to make sure that your process controls are in place. Samples are drawn independently from the technical expert who is the auditor. Samples are tested, in most cases by the SABS, who is credited to test those samples. Two things that need to be complied with. The test report has to be positive, that it meets all the requirements of the standard. And secondly, the test report needs to be an approved test report and a full test report as opposed to a partial test report. It's basically a requirement to obtain the SABS mark scheme. And thereafter, surveillance, of course, post-permit surveillance takes place in terms of administering the mark scheme. So what, in terms of renewable energies, what has been happening at the SABS for the last year or two? We've established a fully functional laboratory to test solar water heaters. It's part of ESCOM's demand-side management program, and the SABS mark scheme is basically required by ESCOM for the ESCOM rebate program. The NAV has been, in terms of capacity, has been improved over the last year. The family standard is 1307 of the SANS reference, a number of other standards as well, including SANS 151. It's homegrown standard, particularly taking care of peculiarities in terms of geographical location or weather changes like hail tests that are currently being conducted as well as part of the tests within the specifications. The compliance is basically the full test report to 1307. It includes collectors, storage tanks, and associated plumbing. A wide variety of tests, including mechanical testing, electrical testing, solar testing, etc. What you see in front of you is basically a thermal performance exposure test that's pictorial, which shows what the tests that's conducted at the SABS. Just another technology which is advancing is heat pump. Basically, it's also part of the Eskom demand side management. It's a rebate system that has been launched by Eskom Oneplus. We set up a brand new laboratory for the testing of heat pumps. The performance standards for the heat pumps are still currently in development. However, the installation maintenance of the heat pumps, that standard has been finalized and has been published. Without going into the technical detail of the heat pump technology, it's basically somewhat, it's a bit different from the geysers, whereby the geysers use electricity to heat the element, and the element basically transfers heat to the water. The difference with heat pumps is that it is the energy from the environment which is absorbed as processes of condensation and evaporation and condensation, energy is transferred, so you get 1 kilowatt of energy together with 2 kilowatts of energy from the environment bringing in 3 kilowatts to heat water, and that's as simple as I can go in terms of explaining the heat pumps technology. This is basically the heat pump laboratory. In the laboratory itself, if you haven't seen a heat pump before, well, what looks like the an air conditioner, that's basically the heat pump currently being tested in form of the performance tests. In terms of wind turbines, the standards division has been very active in this area. We've adopted entire series of the IEC series of 61400 standards, and we've adopted them as South African national standards. These include design, conformity assessment, certification, generation systems, mapping protection. It also includes aspects like communication for monitoring and control of wind power plants. So the entire series of standards are currently available. We've also done a feasibility study which is has been completed and submitted to the Department of Science and Technology, and this is around for capacity testing of wind turbines. In terms of energy efficiency labeling, this is the South African National Standard 941. Okay, it's basically energy efficiency labeling for electrical appliances. This standard was recently published in March of 2012. And we're currently working with the Department of Trade and Industry to look at upgrading the current laboratory capacity and infrastructure to ensure that we can test for these various appliances on labeling. So basically, labs will be able to test against the efficiencies as listed in the labels to ensure that they conform, or verification that they conform with the efficiencies that they say they do, and certainly allow for consumers at the same time to make informed choices regarding the energy labeling system. I think NRCS will talk about the energy labeling system as well. Just moving on in terms of, which I mentioned earlier on, the energy management system, which is ISO 40000, which we've adopted as South African National Standard. There's a lot of work that has gone through on this project in terms of capacity building within the SABS as well as the other technical infrastructure entities, SALAS, as well as SARCA. SANAS is basically responsible for the developing the accreditation system, which they've finalized. SARCA for ensuring that we build capacity in terms of expertise for training in this field. We've hosted a number of workshops, roadshows throughout the country. And finally, the SABS is undergoing training in terms of the specialized auditors that need to be trained to be deemed competent to audit against ISO 50000. There's a project outside of the SABS, where three manufacturers, ArcelorMittal, Galvanor Textiles, as well as Toyota South Africa and Perfection, that are currently undergoing a pilot project on implementation of ISO 50000. And to date, they've shown quite significant improvements on low-cost, no-cost initiatives or interventions in terms of reducing the amount of energy in these organizations. So it's a good report that will be submitted pretty soon for looking into at the SABS. Just in terms of the standards, you'll see that basically the roadmap in terms of the energy efficiency standards, quite a number of them I've already spoke to, like the SANS 941, the energy efficiency label, which is an extreme right size at the lower half of the presentation, the solar water heaters, photovoltaic systems, wind turbine standards. We talk about a wide variety of standards for specific appliances, as well as electric powered vehicles. So these standards have all been established. Quite a number of them are currently under revision as well in terms of updating them. So this is basically the platform. Standards are basically the platform for engaging and developing and further enhancing the implementation of technologies. To acknowledge DGI for providing the funding for our new laboratories at the NABS. This is a new structure that's put in Pretoria, and specifically for the chemical sectors, which includes laboratories like carbon plastics, industrial petrochemicals, chromatography, microbiology, pharmaceutical chemistry, water chemistry, etc. Three of the laboratories have already moved into, have been transferred to new infrastructure, and we're looking forward in the next months to come for the entire portfolio of the chemical industry and laboratories to move into the new buildings. Just in terms of experiences and challenges, I think with identification and product testing, you're always going to have issues regarding financing challenges from SME perspective as well. Because the strategic nature of standards and implementation of standards is very poorly understood in the SME sector, and that's one of the downfalls. No matter how much we promote and go on new roadshows and workshops, etc., that engagement, both at standard development level as well as engagement up front when you have a prototype and ensuring that these prototypes adhere to some sort of two standards before developing something, and then you go back and starting engaging with SABS to start putting standards together, then it's certainly a huge amount of investment lost. So the strategic intention and the understanding of standards is very important, especially in the SME sector. There's huge differences that I mentioned earlier on in product versus system verification. It could be either through ignorance or blatant abuse of the SABS mark that this currently happens in the industry as well. Typical example, if a local manufacturer has the SABS mark on a product, we go and do an audit in his manufacturing site, both the samples test, he gets the mark, and thereafter he starts importing these products and puts the SABS mark on that product, which is no-go zone. That's latent abuse of the SABS mark scheme. There's a lot of innovations happening. We know and understand that technology is advancing at a rapid pace. So too needs our standards development process as well to accommodate these technological advances, and we're trying as far as possible to ensure to build significant capacity and expertise in our standards development arena to keep up with these advances in technology as well. Maintenance of certification requirements by companies, again, there's, and this is not a general rule, but there's certain areas in terms from companies' perspective or business perspective is that you only certify a product because you want to gain access to a specific market or you apply for a specific tender, etc. Once you get it, you don't sustain and maintain that certification scheme. It's a huge no-go zone because you're fundamentally diminishing your quality of good controls and your access to market. And after, if SABS finds you're not compliant with the products and the system, those certifications will be taken away from you, suspended, etc., or even cancelled for that matter. So it's very important to build a mechanism that clients who have already have the SABS mark scheme and system certification, that they maintain that going forward as well. And lastly, obviously, building capacity for testing and certification on our South African national standards as well, which currently SABS is engaging with our shareholders, DTI, and a number of stakeholders and government departments to engage with, developing the relevant standards and at the same time ensuring that we have the right capacity to conduct conformity assessments. And that is the conclusion of the presentation. Thank you.
Good evening, Chair, and also the rest of the House. I'm Mohsen Lobo from NRCTS, which is a national regulator for composite specification. So my presentation will actually touch more of what we're actually doing and also try to actually clarify our role insofar as relating to what SABS is actually doing, because we normally find that there's a lot of confusion as to the role of NRCS and the role of SABS, either on the development of a particular composite specification or the standard and the enforcement part. As my colleague has been indicated, I won't dwell much there, is that we also form part of the technical infrastructure, which is SAPS, NRCS, and also SANAF, in which case SANAF is more responsible for the accreditation process. NRCS was established in 2008, after it was for many years was part of the SNPF, one facultative division. In terms of the WTO obligation under regulatory best practice model, it was actually established that there is a need to separate standard commercial testing lab and product market certification scheme. Hence, there was a need that we need to establish an entity that would play a different role to what SAPS actually playing. And also, there was a lot of outcry that at that stage, the SAPS is actually the referee and the player. Hence, there was a need for the separation of powers. In a nutshell, the purpose of NRCS is to administer the regulation, which we normally call in the compulsory specification. The reason why it's called compulsory specification is that we only administer that regulation after it's defined by the minister, which is our minister, Honorable Ralph Davis, who is the Minister of Trade and Industry. Once it is signed, it becomes the law. That is why it becomes compulsory for each and every industry that is actually manufacturing or importing those products that are regulated by us to comply. Mainly what the regulation will be focusing on is to make sure that the safety aspect of the product is critical, and also the environmental protection. That is where the issue of energy efficiency also comes in, because it falls under the mandate of our legislation where we talk about environmental protection and also on the safety of our public. And as I indicated also is that what we basically regulate, we regulate a product. Either the product that is being imported into our country, or it will be manufactured by our local manufacturer, or the product will be exported. So basically, we cover almost all the activities, either on the exportation side or on the local manufacturing side. And over and above that, we also administer another legislation, which is called the Trade Metrology Act, and the National Building Regulation and Building Standards Act. On the Trade Metrology Act, that is where we look at the weight and measurement of the product, where if you're supposed to have a 50 kilogram of cement, but it is not a 50 kilogram cement, that is one that we need to make sure that if a particular client says it's 50 kilogram of cement, it must make sure that it's 50 kilogram of cement. If it's a brand also again, it must be what has been labeled. And that is why we always monitor and enforce the particular legislation. And also we administer the National Building Regulation, in which I will talk later. That's where the issue of solar water system comes in, because it's all under the National Building Regulation, where we administer on the building regulation side. In terms of our process flow, we are divided into three major components. Firstly, on the development of the compulsory specifications for the regulations. And that's the first part. Once we have developed regulations and it's also been published and signed by our minister and it became the law, then we administer that regulation. We administer it in twofold. Firstly, before you can sell or manufacture any product in our country, you must apply to us and in order to actually obtain a letter of authority or a sales permit. That will allow you, if someone asks you, do you have a permission from NRCS, then you will produce that particular certificate and say, yes, I applied, then I have a certificate. This kind of what we actually looked at is that that particular client will actually test a product which they will use an accredited laboratory, which for example could be SAPS, and then based on that test report, he will submit to us and say, I will meet all the necessary requirements. Then we will look at our regulation vis-a-vis his test report and evaluate his test report together with his product to make sure that his product together with the test report meets our requirement. And if you are certified, then you will grant a letter of authority. But because a person might apply for a letter of authority, using a golden sample, but then when you go to the market, the product then that has been approved is no longer the same product has been actually sold or imported. Hence, we also have a second layer, which is called a market surveillance, where we actually have our in-house inspector. We will go to the retailer, we will go to the manufacturing plant, we will go to, and then also now we have established a new project where we are focusing on the border enforcement, where we will monitor our product even before they reach our consumers, because we have realized that to go into the retailers and to the manufacturer, sometimes it does not yield the desire in which we want to actually achieve, because we'll find that some of those products have already been sold to our consumer. Then what we decided is that we will move to the border enforcement project, where we will make sure that we try to lock out the non-compliant product from coming to our market. And also that it is in line with IPAP 3, which actually indicates that as part of our mandate, we must lock out a non-compliant product. And then most of the product that we actually focus on are the products that fall under the automotive sector. It could be a complete vehicle or the component of the vehicle. And also we also focus on chemical products like a disinfectant product and cement. We also focus mainly on electrical products, for example, the adapter, focus on that, circuit breakers. Almost all the products that are used in our household as electrical appliances. And also we deal with food products like fish, smoked fish, and all of that. So we cover the wide range of the product in the market. And then if we actually find out that a certain product is not compliant after we have done the market surveillance, so that is where the issue assumption comes in, which is another part, another responsibility that we are having, that to make sure that we sanction if we find out that the product does not comply. Now where we actually do our sanction, we issue what we call a directive, which will stop that manufacturer or the importer from selling those products up until we are satisfied that he has done a corrective measures to correct whatever defect that we have initially identified. If we are not satisfied, then we will send those products into the board for the board to take a decision either to destroy those products or to be sent them to the country of origin. But if the court has decided that those products be sent back to the country of origin, we will always want to engage with the regulator on the other side to make sure that those products will go back. Because what we actually found out in some instances that an importer, they will say they will send back the product to the country of origin, but then those products will shift back into our country. So hence, in order to have that monitoring tools, we will liaise with the regulator on the other country to make sure that those products are sent to the country of origin. But another challenge that we're actually finding in sending back to a product to the country of origin, which that is what we don't recommend, is that in some of our African countries, technical infrastructure is of a lesser level than in our South African. So therefore, a importer will actually say that, okay, if I'm not complying in South Africa, I will send this product to Kenya because the requirements in Kenya, they are a little bit lesser than in South Africa. Now, we actually now have to balance the two situations where we are allowing the product that is not compliant to our country to be dumped to another country, which as a South African or part of the African continent is not something which is good. So what we actually do, we don't really sanction the process of sending back to the country of origin unless we are satisfied that it will leave the African shores, not only the South African shores. And then other thing that I will focus on is what we do and what we don't do. What we try to do without the technical regulation, which will be submitted to our minister to be gazetted as a law. But before we draft the technical regulation, it will be a standard, as my colleague has already dealt with on the standard. So SAPS will develop a standard. Then the regulation will be based on the national standard. What we actually do, we're still going to go through the process of consultation, but we'll adopt the particular standard as our baseline in order to make sure that we start the consultation. And then that standard, then it will be promulgated as a compulsory specification, which effectively means that now that standard is no longer a voluntary standard, but whether we like it or not, we are obliged to comply with that particular standard. And furthermore, we register the manufacturers, the importers, and the builders in which they are selling or manufacturing the products that are regulated by us. As I indicated also previously, that we issue a letter of authority before the product can be sold in our market. And however, and above that, as I indicated, we do the inspection and the sanction to enforce compliance and also to remove the unsafe product from the market by destroying them. And over and above that, if the product is already on the market and has already been distributed, what we also do, we issue a media record where we ask the consumers to bring back those products that have already been distributed. By doing so, we also inform the consumer that if they bought the product into a particular shop, they're entitled into a full refund because it was not their problem that that particular product is not unsafe. So why we are doing that is to make sure that not only that we sanction a particular client, but we go a step further in making sure that our consumers are safe. But we also engage on in order to make sure that we educate our consumers because NSS is not well known at this stage since it's a newly established entity. We are now embarking what we call it a campaign. At the moment, we just had a winter campaign where we go to the vulnerable communities like informal settlement and then educate them about a non-compliant product and advise them how to see an unsafe product. For example, if we go to an informal settlement at Gwananga, we focus on the paraffin stoves that are not safe because the stats have shown that those paraffin stoves sometimes they will cause shakes to bear. Then our focus will be built around the product that are used in that particular area. If we go to an area that is electrified, we'll focus on the products that are used in that area. For example, side outlet, circuit breakers, adapters, microwaves, because those are the products that will be used because we have electricity. Why we are doing that is to make sure that not only dealing with the industry now, but we want to use our consumers to assist us also in bringing back those products that are not compliant. Because what the industry sometimes do is that if they know that the consumer cannot identify non-compliant products, they will still go to sell them. But if we educate our consumer, then our consumer can be used as our market intelligence in actually telling us that these products are in our market. What we don't do is to write standards, because that is a function of SNCF, as my colleague has already indicated, and also we don't do testing, because the testing done by the accredited laboratory. But what we do, we sample and we send a sample to the testing facility, and then we use the evidence from the testing facility to make a decision whether to sanction a particular client. Hence, an SNCF play a critical role insofar as us implementing our mandate, because we rely on their evidence insofar as the test report are concerned in identifying whether the product is safe or not. And we don't just regulate. We only regulate for the purpose of enforcing safety and making sure that we are protecting our consumers. So the first question that we will ask before we accept whether we're going to regulate a particular product or not is whether it's going to add value insofar as the safety is concerned. So therefore, if it's an issue of the quality, it should be dealt by SAPS. For us, we'll only be focusing on the safety part. I will now deal with a proposed technical regulation that actually supports an energy efficiency. The first one is the solar water heater, in which case I won't go into detail as I've already been mentioned. So the effort has already been submitted for first targeting, in which case there will be a public comment, and we are just now waiting for our minister to approve it. Then we will start a process of consultation. And then in that one, this is where we deal with a friendship bill system, a thermal collector, in which case it must comply with SANS, which was developed by SABS. And over and above that, we have also promulgated a domestic hot water storage tank, which includes a solar heat pump and electrical appliance. And again, so that one has already been submitted for first gazetting, in which as soon as our minister has approved it, a consultation will commence. In that one, it also has an element of energy, because that is where the energy efficiency also comes in. And over and above that, we also regulate electrical appliances, and we have introduced what for competent presence lamp, which we normally call it a CFL, in order to make sure that the power that you buy, it has an energy efficient and the way it's been labeled, is labeled properly. And as part of our project, we want to eradicate inefficient in Capsa and Land by 2014. Hence, we are making sure that we want to meet that particular target, because that would be in line with what ECOM and then wants to do to make sure that they are rolling out as soon as possible. But at this stage, because we have already identified that it's so difficult for the industry to comply with the certification requirement, as my colleague has indicated, we always engage with the industry. If there's a way of trying to streamline that particular process, but without compromising the relevant quality, we actually amend the certification requirement to ensure that it's top to what we want to achieve at the FDA, because it's a new era that we're just experiencing. So therefore, we, on an ongoing process, we engage with the industry insofar as implementing the particular process, but not only the industry, but we also engage the important role players like the Department of Energy and ESCOM and the DGI and SAPS, because this is a national priority in order to achieve it. And we ever intend to publish an amended regulation by early 2013, hence we are busy now with the process of consultation. And then also on the energy efficiency for the new building, we have published a national building regulations, which was published in November 2011, not to dwell on it, just that one actually included the mandatory use of renewable energy, which included solar and heat pump and other emerging technology for water heating. So basically what that regulation says is that on the new building that will be approved by our building officers, when they are approving a building plan, they must make sure that there is a way where you can use a renewable energy as a way of making sure that we save our energy, because we want to move to that sphere of saving our energy. So therefore, if you submit a business plan, that's one of the things that will be looked at by our building control officers to make sure that it does meet those requirements moving forward. And over and above that, we are busy with the amendment of the electricity record for passenger record, in which case we are also planning to publish it for public comment by early 2013 as one of the initiatives that was identified by our minister. Okay, that's the end of my presentation.
Thank you. I trust and hope we are aware that the whole stance and that next week we're having a 3-day public hearing on energy efficiency. So you'll be joining us. Banking Association?
Good evening. Thank you, Chair, and thank you to everyone for being here this evening. I guess it's quite nice being at the end, because I think a lot of what I wanted to say has already been said by some of the participants, in particular the Department of Energy and SAC, around where the banks are in. But I think more importantly, just for those of you that don't know us, who are we? We're the Banking Association. We're the Trade Association for Commercial Banks in South Africa. Our role is to promote a sustainable competitive...
Yeah, Mr.
I'm Pierre Fetta. I was going to get to that, Chair. Our role is to promote a sustainable, competitive and responsible sector. The core area of our focus is transformation, where the sector is relevant to the majority of our population. My particular role within Banking Association is I chair the Sustainable Human Settlements cluster of committees, sustainable finance, which is why I'm here this evening, critical infrastructure, housing, and agriculture. In turning to the presentation, we were only given a couple of days' notice, so this is not a matter of formal position of Banking Association. What I have done is applied my insights from my engagements with our stakeholders and added some of my own to that. An overview of the presentation is to look at what our role and our contribution is, some of the experiences and lessons we've learned in the IBB process, and a bit of a prognosis on key issues. I wouldn't suggest that I'm a subject matter expert. Have you asked too many hard questions? I might have to go back to my members and seek the technical info for you. Independent power producers. Our view as the banking sector that this has been a great success story. You know, the RLP was only introduced only 17 months ago, and I think in 17 months a hang of a lot has really been achieved. You go back a year in our life, only 2% came out of renewable energy. We know what the target is for 2030, but what our target is for 2016. But if I look at 2012, what we've achieved in our first three rounds of the RPP, is we've already achieved 68% of our target. Our first plant goes live next year, April, and then we're going to see them rolling into place. If we look at what the RPPs, the financial injection that's taken place, we estimate that it will be somewhere in the region of about 100 billion rand, of which 70 billion rand will come out of debt finance. Of that, commercial banks have provided or will provide in the next two rounds about 80% of this funding. Another success, I think, is the improvement in local content, and the speaker from SAREC spoke about that earlier on. I think also the competition has heated up quite nicely. Prices have already started being driven down. And I think what for me is extremely pleasing is the fact that you have five times as many bidders as projects that actually get off the ground. And I think at the same time, there's a lot of financial interest. I can tell you now that the big commercial banks, who provided all the initial funding, all sit in waiting for the next couple of rounds of RPP. I know that within the organisation, they've made substantive allocations of capital available. They're just waiting for the right projects. Our view is that renewable energy is at a critical stage. I think the early signs are encouraging. All the above points point to that, but I think there's a long road ahead, and I think we need to keep our feet on the ground, which I'll talk about a little bit in our prognosis. The commercial banks exist to lend money and to do transactional banking. They will compete and exploit on any viable and responsible opportunity. As long as something's commercially viable and sustainable, they'll be there. The DFIs, on the other hand, and it was explained earlier on this evening, they initiate that lead in the sub-commercial area, and I think one of the big opportunities is risk sharing between DFIs and the commercial sector, that we create a seamless partnership that can actually move projects in where at the moment we're a little bit disjointed, and I'll talk about that because I think we do have a solution there as well. If you have a look at where our banks are, they've actually done say a lot in the media, but they've actually done a hang of a lot in the space. Some of these points I'm not going to elaborate too much on, but I think there are some significant accomplishments. The first is that Green Exchange Traded Fund of Nedbanks, where the past year it's actually outperformed the JSE by 30%, which I think is really significant. I think there's over 100 million rand that's already been invested in CDM. Capital is certainly not an issue for commercial banks. They are well capitalized, they're eager to pay. The banks themselves are committed to our green economy, and it makes financial sense to them for all the reasons that you see in this slide. And they've spent over 100 million rand in that area already. Outside of that, they've built their IT platforms. When we started experiencing power outages, I've said there that the cost is unknown, but I would suggest that it's in excess of 100 million rand that has been put in place for backup generators to make sure we are sustainable, that if there is a problem, and we can work through it. Two of our banks who have built new buildings already, they've received five-star Green Star awards, which I think is quite a nice achievement as well. Some of the experiences and lessons that we've learned, and here I want to touch on challenges. Risk was touched on earlier on this evening. I think time constraints for all parties, and that includes bidders and developers, is tight. inexperienced, you know, that we, and my colleague from DIE spoke about the industry being in its infancy, and a lot of the people coming into the process are inexperienced as far as bidding is concerned, and then within bidding process is always an element of bureaucracy. And I think one of the things that is a challenge, but I think which has been managed very successfully, is the balance between social and economic imperatives of our country. What for me is significant is that in round two, you had purely parties actually starting to create community trust and what, which was not there in round one. So I think we're going to see a lot more there and a much better balance going forward, but certainly the amount of interest reflects that balance for me. All manufacturing is low, especially in the PV area, and I think there's a need for an enabling environment there. One of the things, and it was touched on by the SENEC presentation, is the need for finance reassurance for international investors and market longevity. I think there has to be certainty around feeding tariffs. SENEC spoke at length about the need for manufacturers, independent power producers, developers to have medium to long-term certainty as opposed tariffs being changed on a constant basis. And then I think something that has to be managed very carefully by government is the fact that the state is both a referee and a player. Eskom is a monopoly, and it has been starting to be broken up, but you need to manage that well to actually crowd in the private sector rather than crowd them out. Critical focus areas for us are market certainty. There's nothing that the private sector, including lenders, hate more than uncertainty and policy impasse where things drag on and we see constant changes. In the solar water diesel space, we've seen stop-start a couple of times in as many years. And you can carry that forward into other areas as well. And I think policy certainty for us is absolutely critical. Local content, very important, and was touched on earlier on. The need for foreign investment into South Africa to bring that expertise in as far as manufacturing is concerned. And then something which for me is quite exciting is getting suitable finance in place. Whilst the banks have been very keen, I think there has been a bit of a disjuncture between the DFIs and the commercial banks. We haven't spoken and partnered close enough up to now. And what we have facilitated is that National Business Initiative will coordinate a green finance project. We've started on that project. It's going well at the moment. We're hoping for an outcome by the end of this year that we can actually create that process that will actually make it a lot easier for participants to access finance. Lack of expertise was touched on earlier on. And then I think for me, personally, the decoupling of the value chain to promote competition is absolutely critical, and the market, you know, that's what will enable the market to grow beyond its infancy. Infrastructure support was also touched on earlier on this evening. A prognosis, you know, our view is that what you really, if you analyze the position, you're actually looking at behavioral economics, and the market will respond accordingly. As long as something is commercially viable, as long as it makes economic sense, especially, you know, and there you can include consumers in that, and as long as it's sustainable, it will, the market will react and it will take off. We've seen the early indications where it's good and it's positive, and those will continue as long as the right messages go into the market. You need that enabling environment, the state support. I think you've got to have the right level of regulatory environment. The big caution that I would urge, though, is that don't overdo it, because there's nothing that the private sector hates more than over-regulation. It adds cost. It delays processes. It creates inefficiencies. And it chases them away. They'd rather play somewhere else if there's too much regulation. I think there needs to be competition. It must pose opportunities for all the players. Market certainty I've touched on. And then finally, a point that I'd like to elaborate on a little bit is consumer education. I'm not convinced that we are doing enough in that space. You know, I want to suggest that if you are looking for information on something like a solar water geyser, there isn't a outside of the Eskom flight information on their website, but outside of that, there's none. There are 110 different small parties putting out disparate pieces of information. as a consumer, you need to very clearly understand what your options are and how you fit your price tag to the quality and so on, and what the ramifications are. Consumer ed, I think, is critical, especially in our country where we are putting a lot of solar ward geysers into our affordable housing and low-income housing and subsidy housing areas. And those consumers, we really need to make sure that they understand what they need to do to get optimal use out of the product and longevity out of it. I think as South Africa, we need to start focusing on our implementation. We put a lot of policy in place. We've had a lot of debate. There's a hang of a lot of research that's been done. I think we now need to just start looking at prioritizing what it is we need to do. And I think it's okay to make a mistake. I think we need to talk less. We need to worry less about perfecting our policy and just go and do it. A year ago, I was in the States, and it was quite interesting. There was quite a lot of stuff on television. But the president was very concerned about jobs and the need to create jobs and the need for America to bring back its manufacturing capability that it had exported to China. And he got his senior congressman to around the table, multi-parties, and he said, guys, we need to bring our manufacturing back. We need to create jobs. Go out and do it. They sat around the table. They did two things. The one thing they did is they said, let's see if there are any regulations that impede manufacturing in this country. Let's simplify that, number one. Number two, let's get in our motor cars. Let's go and see those guys running the factories in the manufacturing space and find out what it is that they need. When they got there, they found that the hard skills had all disappeared because that component had gone over to China. They immediately looked to put the necessary training in place to get that skills built up. There was no deliberation with the trade unions. There was no deliberation around where I would locate my training facility, whether I do it in the day or the evening. We in our country will talk for 2 or 3 years about it before we actually get down to doing it. And I think that's the competition that we actually need to understand we're up against. In South Africa, I think we need to see our local content and job creation in the border value chain sense. I think there was quite a lot touched on about that earlier on this evening as far as servicing and implementation and so on is concerned. And we need to understand we operate in the global context, and if we operate in that context, we need to find out what our core competencies are, and I think transport is one of those that from a regional perspective we can take advantage. It was mentioned earlier on this evening. We've got to look at where we can compete. We need to be a stable environment from a macroeconomic and political perspective, and we need to give those investors protection in our country that they prepared to put their manufacturing plant in South Africa in preference to them going into some of our neighbouring countries. And then I think we've got to just remember that we've got to continue to balance our social and economic demands, otherwise we're going to chase away both local and international investors. At the moment, there's a big head of steam up. We're doing very well. There's an over supply of interested parties. We need to make sure that continues over the next couple of years. And that's the end of my presentation. I don't have a thing, any questions, but I'd just like to thank you, Jim. And questions later on.
Thank you, Master. That was all I've input. We did invite the insurance sector as well. We have felt it's another variant in the finance, but unfortunately, the person who's supposed to come couldn't make it. And here we are. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, let's talk. And more implementation as the planning association has just said. I'll allow the honourable members first to make comments and questions, and then open up so people took as much copious notes as possible. Over to you, honourable member. Mr. Green.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a number of questions, which I'll put to different directors as well. Just to the Department of Energy, look, I'm not going to get too involved in this because we get huge opportunities to challenge you on another forum. But just talking about the electrification target of universal access by 2014, which I think we all accept that we're not going to reach. And During the constituency period, I was up in the Eastern Cape, and thankfully the Department of Energy did send out officials to look at one particular community that we were trying to get electricity to. So I've got some huge insights into the processes and the problems that we're having with the rollout. And when you talk about the KfW fund, which I think is about $250 million that's been set aside to put the other homes into the Eastern Cape, the problem that I've been told is that, in fact, we can't spend that money at the moment. We can't roll out the solar homes at the moment, because what often happens is you go into an area and you find that it's been designated by Eskom, that Eskom is going to roll out the grid within the next 5 years. Often it doesn't in fact happen, and so these communities are then stuck because they don't want to take the solar home system for fear that they're going to be put to the back of the queue when Eskom actually does roll out the grid. So this is a major problem that we're going to have to actually overcome. My suggestion though is that if you think out of the box around this, is that perhaps what we should be doing is, as opposed to putting in singular solar home systems, is let's look at possibly building small mini-grids with a solar park in that particular area, so that at least communities then can benefit from solar energy in the meantime while they wait for the grid to come. And when the grid does come, they can then connect to the grid, the solar panels, and we can get renewable steam back onto the grid, so they can get the benefit of both. It's just something to consider, because I think we really need to break this logjam that we have around electrification. I know that the department's working hard, but we seem to be running up against small details which aren't fair enough. So then you talk about SORI. I mean, I'm really not going to talk too much about SORI, but I've been told by... sure. But I mean, just to make a factor that I really don't think we have moved fast enough on this. And certainly having spoken to some of the embassies, I mean, what I've been told is that the Treasury did, you can't even refer to it as SORI anymore. I think that's kind of abandoned the concept. And I understand what Treasury is trying to do. They're trying to get the best value for money in terms of the relationships that they have with these donor countries. But I think that we run the risk of really destroying the goodwill that was displayed at COP17 with SORI. And I really think that a lot of that money might have to go to other countries if we don't start to get together on that. So that's the last thing I'm going to say about SORI. Hopefully we can challenge it in another form. And then on SABS, the problem, when I spoke to some water heater manufacturers last year, and some of the companies that were in fact going bankrupt because they actually expanded their operation in anticipation that there'd be a huge demand for the high pressure system. That demand didn't in fact materialize, certainly not to the extent that they expected. And then they ran into problems. But one of the problems that they did identify as well is the high cost of testing. I mean, they said it was about R600,000 to test their product at SBS. And they also said every time that they add any components to it, they have to send the whole unit up to Pretoria again to be tested. And that this would really be a major break on their finances. And one of the responses that I heard was that, in fact, SBS's model now is to move to more profit-making, that you need to, in fact, fund your own activities through what you charge industry. And I'm not sure if we need to revisit that, because I think that, you know, standards are an essential part, but we cannot have high prices for small, particularly small companies, which clearly can't afford to pay these kinds of tariffs. So maybe we need to relook at them, maybe the system needs to fund SBS more, and you need to reduce some of the testing prices around that. That is something to consider. Then in terms of banks, what I wanted to look at there was, I mean, I've always said that the problem with energy efficiency, water efficiency, all of that, it's not an economic problem. The stuff makes sense. Once you install it over 3 to 4 years, it pays itself back. I mean, I've done it with my solar water, I've done it with my grey water system, all of that. The problem is the upfront payments that people have to make, particularly households. Have banks looked at particular financing schemes that they can offer to households to install, to retrofit their buildings? So, for instance, can you then expand on, for instance, to put in a kind of green initiative that you can then pay back over a 20-year period, but in fact you get the benefits over a shorter time? Because I really think it's a financial problem that we face here, not so much an economic one, and I think the banks need to come to the party on this particular issue. And then just lastly, on the building regulations that you mentioned, the NGIS, what I want to know is who actually is enforcing these regulations. You mentioned that you've got building officers, but I spoke at a conference on Tuesday, the International Impact Assessors, and I mentioned this regulation, and no one had actually heard of this. And they said that when they're telling builders of new estates, for instance, you need to put solar water heaters in, the right to do that, say, no, we don't want to do it, it's an upfront cost. We don't get the benefit because we're the landlord, not the tenant. But I said that actually it's compulsory in terms of this regulation. But there seems to be a gap between this regulation being out there and in terms of its enforcement. So I'd like to know who's enforcing, have we got enough enforcement power, and do we need to bring in the municipalities to look at how they can actually push this forward? Because I think it is a vital, vital cost in our wheel, but I don't think it's been used properly at the moment. I'm just interested to hear your comments. Thanks.
Thank you. Prof, anything? Okay. If that's the case, I still have switching up. Or there, and I try and hope people will introduce themselves. I would like to be unfair, but initially I'll allow people a maximum of 2 minutes. Then we can have another round. I've got the committee secretary to do timekeeping. Maximum of 2 minutes, and then I'm sure everybody who made a presentation is aware that they are part of the panel, notwithstanding where they are sitting. Okay, over to you, sir. Introduce yourself first, please.
Hi, my name is Zubair Habib. I'm representing the IDC. Reference was made to the IDC in a couple of presentations. I just thought I'd touch very briefly on certain points of our functioning. Obviously, as a financing institution, that's our core role. Mention was made of possible innovative financing solutions and concessionary rates. We are driving local manufacturing very, very tough. I'm working on the metals unit, which is separately from our green unit. The Green Unit focuses more on funding carbon credits and project developers. We focus on the local manufacturing side. Where we do give concessionary finance is prime minus 3% if the job creation potential is strong. Additional to this, we give capital breaks, understanding that factories need a certain amount of time to establish themselves after drawing down before they can be commercially viable. We've seen a lot of interest expressed in local manufacturing, but more than the pricing of the finance, I think, is the point that was mentioned a few times tonight, and that certainty of the market. While our input costs are higher than foreign suppliers, I think our market is a little bit richer as well than some of the countries where these traditional manufacturers have been set up. A strong entry channel for people looking to reach up has been our Green Unit, where developers are looking to meet the local content requirements and refer potential suppliers into our unit. We haven't had as much success as we would like, again the barrier being market certainty. We are engaged currently on the PV side with two foreign partners with strong technical background. I think that's a model that seems to work well. People with technical experience give us the comfort that they're not going to be putting substandard products into the market. They also happen to be financially more willing to contribute towards the establishment of a project. There are a number of local partners without the required technical experience and without the required financial risk. So it sort of organically works itself out that the strongest partners happen to be strong in technical and financial experience. Our requirement for market certainty as well is a little bit of an obstacle more than on the green side. So on the project side, I think the revenues for the future are more certain given the contracts that are signed, whereas on the local manufacturing side, the buyers have more flexibility to change their terms of reference. Again, as was mentioned earlier, it takes about 6 years possibly for a factory to become viable by itself, and the market is looking for that kind of certainty. I must say though that industrial development zones have been a huge help to potential local entrants. That's something that's working very well as the local content requirements. The GTI also gives grants on new equipment purchase, and they give an additional grant if such equipment is coming from a foreign country. So what we've done as IT is we're trying to roll out these grants as part of the new player's equity contribution. I think that goes a long way in toughening the blow on the capital outlay, and is a good example of inter-agency cooperation, number one, and an innovative financing mechanism as well. Another part that we do is we finance the equity portion of the workers' trust, bearing in mind that these don't vest within short periods if the project itself takes 6 years to find root. But it is something else that we've incorporated using funds available from foreign funding institutions as well as our own balance sheet. And it's another example, as I mentioned, of innovative financing mechanism, and it does make it more appealing for foreign entrants into the market. We do encourage people who are setting up locally to look at neighboring countries as well as higher cost markets where they're already established. We're currently engaging with the European manufacturer on the PV side, and their business plan includes a component of relocating higher cost manufacturing facilities to South Africa for export into other markets. Thanks.
Yes, I'd rather start giving numbers, that's number one, or number two, Prof. P.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would
number three. Okay. No. This is the best.
Okay, thanks. I'll be brief. It's a question to the Department of Energy. And mention was made of, I think it was 100 million homes that would get solar cookers. Now, we're not very excited about that because they've been around for about 20 years and the first wave came from an NGO from overseas. And in South Africa, we did a few tests in communities. And the lady that was supposed to use it rejected it outright. First of all, who's going to be there to prepare the food? Leaving it with the children, then not only the food gets stolen, but the entire set of also gets stolen. We had other feedback when Rotarians got very interested 10 years ago. We had feedback from India. They said, show us a housewife that will stand in front of the house, showing their community, this is what I'm trying to cook, because you have 2 or 3 hours to show them. So I would really request that this is being reconsidered because we'd really be throwing away good money after something that the community doesn't want. But as a counter offer, I could rather suggest, if the money is available, that one actually develops the South African product, and that is a patented solar sewing machine. It uses no batteries. After we patented it at the CPUT, we actually had a test site, thanks to funding from USA, and the world's first solar sewing station is based at Klipkamp, which is near Bitterfontein, or beyond Bitterfontein, along the west coast. And that would be a positive exercise, and we could give more details later on. The only snag is that each sewing machine that has to get a PV panel would double in price. The system would double in price. And that is really what renewable energy costs in many cases. Then I have another little question, and this time to the SAES. It's a general question. I know with the solar water geysers that we have M&V audited for Eskom for 6 years. They've become very expensive since SAES had to devise their test, which took them 3 years. Now the question is, having taken so long to devise these units, the cost escalated. Our initial prototype payback period was 2.5 years. In the meantime, it might be 10 years. I hope these things last 10 years. Mine did, which we had for 10 years. So the real appeal is that does the SABS's rules allow to do, let's say, a backup test? Because many of these that have been rolled out, even with an SABS mark, I doubt it will survive 10 years because the ordinary geyser that you install in the flat, not solar, they've got their life cycle is about 2 or 3 years each time. They just make a 3-year period. So the appeal is, could any further test be done almost by tracking the product that is attracting a lot of money? Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Ntombi. I'm from the Department of Trade and Industry. My first question is to Sarah. Your suggested solution, solution number 4, you're actually suggesting that maybe bidders can submit 2 bids. You're suggesting that maybe bidders can submit two bids, different prices corresponding to different levels of local content. And my question is, how practical is it from a cost perspective, seeing that it's very expensive to prepare a bid for submission. And then my second question to the Banking Association. When we presented the local content requirement 2 weeks ago at the BIRA conference, we got a bit of a negative vibe from one of the banking institutions with regards to local content. And well, understandably so, because the more of the concern was with regards to the risk that the banking sector had to take in establishing new manufacturing. So my question is, as a banking association, do you share this view? And if so,
how can you engage with government so that we can make sure that we work towards the same objective? Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Just two lines, Chair. 3 years ago, I sat in a class where...
Name myself, please.
My name is John Natan, and I'm from One World Sustainable Investment. 3 years ago, I sat in a class where five venture capitalists were addressing a team of, or a class of, executive leadership students. And I posed one question to them, how many SMMEs have they supported? And they told me they couldn't find them. My question today is, the financial institutions, IDC and the Banking Association, and the other players who make presentation today, what is the scale of funding that they have specifically targeted towards the SMME sector? Because you read everywhere that this country's economy will only get to where it's supposed to if that sector gets the support that it deserves. I hold the view that it's not getting that support. And therefore, I will end with a request to the chairperson that the portfolio committee find a way to develop a toolkit that focuses on this particular aspect going forward. Thank you.
I'm sure you give us a one page on that idea of a toolkit. I see there's a hand this side. Yes.
My name is Omar Shah. I'm representing the company called Izimungubungu Vintage Converter as a shareholder. And I would like to comment on the presentation that has been given by Ion Vandenberg, representing SAREC. Izimungubungu Wind Energy Converter has been founded in 2009 as the first local wind turbine manufacturer of 2.5 megawatt turbines here in South Africa. We have adopted German technology, and we are, by concluding a license and now a transfer agreement with the German company called Carolin. We have successfully managed to assemble the first turbine. That assembly process has been supervised by Aerodyne. The test runs were successful, as well as the blade manufacturing were successful. However, we are currently facing the risk of being liquidated, and I can surely stress on the point what the previous speaker has made. The support for startup companies like ours is very limited. The access to funding is an uphill battle. We learned today that apparently local content is even important for private banks. I regretfully must admit we haven't experienced this kind of mindset. The guarantees that have been referred in the presentation from Johan is indeed a problem for us. As a startup company, one can imagine that we do not maintain a balance sheet that allows to provide a guarantee that would be acceptable for lenders. So we have asked at various occasions government to look into that and potentially provide support. We unfortunately haven't received any reply in this regard. And the last thing what I would like to mention is the current IPP procurement process does not allow, or basically does not support the development of a local industry. Especially in terms of the large-scale IPP procurement process, local industry is left in the dark or in the cold. And also the small-scale IPP procurement process, as it designed for now, does not support the development of a local industry. The megawatt that's been allocated per round, 25 megawatt, is too low, and the 5 megawatts per project is certainly too low to attract any wind farm developers to put any effort in this kind of project. And we have basically asked the government to rather design a small-scale IPP procurement process on a consistent basis, so that we basically do not depend only on the bid windows, but rather have a consistent market demand that would allow us to secure supply contracts at any time. And we basically call on government to reframe, or basically to redesign the market mechanism to support the development of a local industry, and we are more than happy to liaise with government to discuss all the challenges we are facing currently. Thanks very much.
That's a bit painful, because I remember I was here in November last year, and we were one of the people who actually gave us a nice shock. I say a nice shock because whilst they were, you know, prophecies of doom and gloom that the local manufacturing cannot be doomed, you were the first people that said, look, we are already on the field actually about to start engaging in manufacturing. Fortunately, IPC and DGI are here. Surely you might, if you are not yet, engage with them. Because I would like to see a single company closing down at this stage. You know, it's too painful to see that. Because we really want to, as I said at the beginning, to see as minimal living quotas as possible. That's the fundamental reason of having creating this platform today. But thanks for the input. Dr. Demir.
Chair, members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. My name is Billy Demir from Sandiri. I think while we're discussing the whole option of how do you fund renewables, I think there's another dimension that we just have to look at. I think there is room for the small-scale independent power producers and wind farms, solar, etc. But one of the key things that I think we keep on missing is a question of where do you feed this in? If you want to feed into the grid, you've only got one choice today, and that is you sell it to Eskom. Now, if you talk about smaller units, where do you sell this? Because if you consider the municipalities in this equation, where I believe should become an off-taker, currently our Municipal Finance Management Act doesn't allow them to buy from you. They can only buy from a state entity, i.e. Eskom. They can't buy from a private company. The current legislation doesn't make provision for it. And I was just wondering whether that is not an avenue that we should explore and start asking the question, how do you enable a municipality to buy? Secondly, if you look at the current legislation says a municipality can only buy from who is the cheapest. Now, we all know the price of renewables for the next couple of years, they will still be more expensive than grid. So it implies that the municipality can never be an off-taker. And if you look at the Cape Town Darling Farm, the only reason why they could sign that contract is they signed it before the MFMA was promulgated in its current format. So I think that is something that we need to consider, and I don't know whether the DOE, I don't think they are really the department that should be looking at between COPTA and Treasury. I think there should be serious attention be paid to the MFMA and the ability of municipalities to buy renewable energy.
Thanks so much, Dr. Bia. Can you pause now and get the panel to respond? Anyone? Oh, memories.
To comment on the comment or the suggestion on looking at the mini grid. Let me just indicate that Sanedi has already been brought on board to look at the approach on mini grids, and is already participating at an international platform to get an international perspective and contextualize that within the country. And we engage in National Treasury in terms of the funding with respect to the mini grid, especially that. On Sali, you would recall that in April we were here to present about the progress. One of the things that we mentioned was, it could look like at the moment we are very slow in terms of addressing the issues of enabling environment with respect to the funding mechanism. And one of the strong points that came out was this is a cross-cutting issue. It's not only about funds flowing into the country, but we need to make sure that there is an integrated approach on how to deal with the legislative framework. There is issues of PFMA, issues of, from the IPEP perspective, from the energy policy,
And like when the phase one was concluded, there were key recommendations that were made in terms of in-depth analysis on certain things. And when I'm talking about the funding models that department, I mean, National Treasury is looking at, indeed, I mean, they are confirming and like work is in progress in that regard. I am not aware of National Treasury not looking into the matter because the two DDs have engaged, I mean, at the end of May, and like as I speak, the matter is already being within the MTF process. And also, there is a cabinet memo in relation to the, I mean, the program itself. So I can confirm and, I mean, allay fears in terms of we're moving very slow or maybe it's something that we shouldn't, I mean, look into because it would really take us backwards. We have already acknowledged as a country that indeed renewable energy high costs need to be addressed. And like for us to move forward, we even engaged other international players who are looking into similar models, like for example, Norway on their model, which is more or less what we're looking at. They call it, I mean, energy plus. So, Honorable Hoyleng and the members in the House, I would like to assure you that work is in progress. And if maybe you were to take an example, you know where we come from in terms of feed-in tariffs. There was, I mean, so much cry in terms of us moving slow, but we had to contextualize the issues and look at it in a more broader approach to make sure that we address all the issues that might be hindrances as we start implementing. As you would note, I mean, the countries that have signed, money is there in terms of flowing into the country, but would it be, I mean, better or best for money to flow without the enabling environment? And that needs to be looked at into, I mean, in a broader perspective so that when we do, when we implement, we get it right, I mean, in the first instance. And also, I just want to touch on the question of the National Building Regulations on who is enforcing. Yes, you are right in terms of the issues around enforcement on these regulations. I was just sharing with my colleague from and to say we're looking into the legal opinion. I'm not sure whether you are aware that Cabinet approved the establishment of a project steering committee where all key departments are part of it. And one of the things was after the promulgation of the regulation was to look at the implementation part of it, which looks at enforcement. And like the specifics that we had to look at was to say, I mean, between the Minister of Trade and Industry as well as the Minister of Energy, looking at, I mean, two pieces of legislation, which one would be more best suited in terms of implementation? Yes, we're acknowledging that the municipalities have to be, I mean, on board. But like looking at the legislative landscape, how do we go about it? On Tuesday, we had a meeting between ourselves, Trade and Industry, Department of Energy, my colleague, I mean, organization, in terms of unpacking the legal opinion to say this is how we're mapping it out in terms of making sure that when it gets to the municipality in relation to building plans, this is how it would be done. And one of the key issues that is already, I mean, like coming out, its capacity within municipality as to whether we have that capacity and if not, what are other recommendations that we can look at. And there was a question on, I would just address the question from my side and pause. There is a comment on the clean cook stove. I need to highlight the point that in the presentation I indicated that we're dealing with it together with Department of Science and Technology. Yes, there are behavioral issues when you're introducing any new technology to make sure that it's accepted. So one point is to look, contextualize it to the South African situation without imposing it in a more of cut and paste approach. I agree with you. Those are the things that we need to look at before we can even roll out. The issue about localization, that is not debatable. It's very clear that on all the technologies that we're bringing into the country, we need to make sure that there is time frame in case at the moment it's not manufactured locally. Within a shorter period, how do we make sure that it's manufactured locally? Because job creation is one of the key objectives that one can't even debate on. The last point was on how do we enable municipalities to engage on the small scale in power generation. On this one, we have started engaging with National Treasury. At the moment, we have got an inception report that deals with the environmental legal scale in terms of how to deal with that matter, not only on landfill gas, but also on small-scale hydro. So we're deliberating on the inception report in terms of what are the challenges and what are the potential enablers in that respect. So definitely, we have already engaged that this is part of the Independent Power Producers Program. The first two windows that have already been, I mean, gone up, you would know that there was a call for information in relation to the small project. In line with that, the inception report is already looking at the environmental scale, so it's being addressed at the moment. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. If having had the benefit of hearing various presentations tonight, what I can perhaps share with the House is my impression that the things we talk about fall into two clear categories tonight. And the one is things that happen at relative medium and smaller scale, often at the household level, and we're talking about solar water heaters, solar cookers, heat pumps. Something where a house owner can make a decision that he wants to change the way that he does things, and he spends anything from very little money up to maybe a few 10,000 rand of money. And on that level, having heard the SBS and the other presentations, I'm reasonably confident that we may make some mistakes along the way, but we will find our way. And it's logical that localization will eventually happen on that level. The other thing that we spoke about tonight is a completely different kettle of the fish, and that's the large-scale commercial procurement program under the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program, where it can take 2 to 4 million rand just to prepare a bid, where there sometimes it might cost 2 billion rand to build a single project, where you cannot get past the bank without a certified project, a guarantee, then the bank will definitely, the person who does anything but show you the door will be fired, because that's international banking practice. It's very difficult to ask the bank to do it in any other manner. So within that context, apologies, we then come to the IWEC situation, which I have to agree with the chair is highly regrettable that they have to be in a situation, and because they're a pioneer, they had vision and they took the initiative to establish something in South Africa. But they're running up against that guarantee and certification issue that I discussed at length, and I would like us all to go away and think some more about how we can solve it, because the answers are not necessarily simple. To just answer the question that was put to me by DTI, and I understood the question to be it's expensive to bid already, so if you tell people that they can bid at one level or at another level, how much more expensive would it be? My answer is it doesn't have to be more expensive at all, because if you tell that you can build a 30% localization level or at a 50% or both, if you choose just the one or the other, it'll cost you no more. If you choose to do both, my expectation is it'll make a minimal difference to the cost of preparing your bid. But remember, this is voluntary, so if anybody thinks it's too expensive, then they just won't do it. But you will still get the spread, the one bidding at the one level, the other project at the other level, and you'll get much greater level of clarity around it. Thank you, Shay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Chair Demana. I'm also from the Department of Trade and Industry. I just want to talk to the cost of testing. We heard how important testing is from the speaker. I just want to mention the department last year launched an incentive scheme to assist firms to get their products tested. In terms of the scheme, conformity assessment for products that firms produce can get assistance from the DTI. There are various levels of incentives that one can get. One can get up to 30%, 40%, 50% of the cost, depending on your investment,
the number of jobs that you have in your firm and the size of your enterprise. So through this scheme, which we call the Manufacturing Competitiveness Enhancement Program, we are able to assist the firms that do the manufacturing, as well as the facilities that do the tests. So if a laboratory, for instance, wants to expand or buy new equipment so that they can do the tests that are required, they can apply to the DTI scheme and get the assistance that they require. So I think this scheme is quite useful for even small enterprises because they can have the test that they require done by SABS or somebody else who is accredited, supported by the government. I think perhaps what is missing is that we have not promoted the scheme as widely as possible. I think one of the key areas that the scheme looks at is actually the green industry, where we are trying hard to promote that in the green industry, because of the fact that we have decided on local procurement, we're designating specific products, and we are supporting them financially through IDC, as we've already had. We also want to make sure that all those products that we're designating, they meet the requisite quality, and they're actually going to perform. And the only way to make sure that that happens is if all these tests that are required are actually done. We worry that if we have a segmentation, that products from smaller players will be tested under a different regime, that might not work. That's why we would prefer that the bodies that do the testing actually have a set price that they offer to the market, rather than have a whole lot of segmentation that will be difficult for them to actually administer. So we prefer that people who want to get their product tested, they apply to get assistance from the DTI instead, and then go and pay the full amount at anybody who is doing the test. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. But I would have asked the panel to respond. I see there's a hand. One of the things that I'm keen to know, have that the core role players or key stakeholders been engaging on these issues? Because honestly, I don't pick up this tunadering or any form of robust engagement. And we entered into this area with mixed feelings, anxiety, keenness, uncertainty. But deep inside, we resolved that we're going to enter into the area of renewable energy. And because the South Africans, we have done a couple of other things, miraculously, so we'll also get through this one. And as the banking associations look, every venture into any green field, that we'll make a few mistakes. But one of the expectations from our side, particularly as public representatives, is that, stakeholders, when they have a common area to engage in, like financing or the certification area, they definitely have to engage with one another. If I can get that, maybe from Mr. Van der Berg before he takes off. Have you, and if you have, to what extent, what's the take of what has happened? If not, why has it not happened?
Chair, I think your question is a very good one. That is what has to happen. I must say, I think it has happened to an extent, but we came from, just last week, I was lucky to be in Germany with a representative from the DGI because GIZ paid for us and other people to go. So now we know each other very well and we've got the engagement. But that's the process that needs to happen. So just bringing the four industry associations together in a meaningful way has taken a bit of time. The other thing that has happened is, could the process kick off so quickly that the people in the renewable industry are extremely stressed in terms of time and work at the moment. Some people work 7 days a week out of the office at the moment. So it's been a challenge to get people's attention because the backgrounds are quite tight and you have to just get your work done in due course. But I think the engagement has happened. DBSA hosted an localization in Durban that we co-hosted with them on the 15th of June, and ongoing discussions with DTI, but more of it has happened, and for that I can just thank the chair for the for the session that we've had, because I think if, you know, if nothing else, it definitely plays a role to teach us to work together better.
Still on that, Meneer, you know, bank association, say capital is not the problem. There are other areas, you know, guarantees and things. I have expectations sitting from here that surely one way or another, in a collective way, you know, when there was feedback into SAREC or SAPSI or SAWIA or whatever, they would have been an instinctive reaction that let's go and check with banks, you know, how do we handle this? And even if they said yes, you know, that there's this long arduous process, and sort of overall, the government of the day wants this issue to be rolled out, and is there any way, not of circumventing or cutting corners, but of really seeing where there could be a way of ensuring some form of flexibility, of course, within the, you know, reasonable measures, respecting statutes. That's what I'd like to hear. I don't say I'm forcing you like out of the stone, but just to say, have you raised this business? Because I thought today the bank council would say, no, we don't have the box, but they say capital is not the issue. It's elsewhere. Now, have you engaged on those issues?
And Chair, yes, and again, you know, the reason why we put that last slide in our presentation, you know, all on one page to say what is the role that each institution needs to play, and with government, academia, industry, and I somehow can't remember what the other one was just immediately. But, you know, we looked at each of the solutions that we suggested, and we said, who must play a role? And in each case, when there's a role for somebody to play, we made a tick. So that's an ongoing process. It's far from perfect at the moment, but in our view, that's the way forward, and that's the way we'd like to engage with any of those role players. We really are open to doing that.
Okay, but yes, I'm looking at that. But I trust and hope people can also respond to SAG's, you know, suggestions. Banking Council.
Thank you, Chair. I think there were three questions.
Can you bring the microphone closer to you?
I'm so sorry. Thank you, Chair. I think there were three questions for me, but before I do that, in terms of SAREC, I'd like to pass across my business card, and I think we actually need it today, because I think there were some very constructive comments passed there, and I can speak on behalf of NDR, who are going to facilitate this process, this project that we're busy with, and that I think we should bring SAREC into that project as well, as a part of that. We do that proper engagement that you referred to. Just in response to the three questions, the first one was on the Honourable Mr. Fraling around, I don't think banks are doing enough. I would agree with that to an extent. 18 months ago, and I didn't want to say it this evening, but I need to say it now. 18 months ago, two of the major mortgagees were actually going to launch a product, and they actually withdrew it. This is a stop-spot of ISCOM that I spoke about earlier on in my presentation, this market certainty, the uptake between then and now, certainly in the middle and upper income market, hasn't been as good as it should have been. I think it's not, you can't lay that blame purely at market certainty. You also need to look at over-indebted consumers. I think we've also got to look, you know, where, you know, we're sitting at the moment in our country where 74.2% of the average family's disposable income is getting paid off in debt. 46% of consumers have got indebted credit track records. So we have an overburdened consumer. Having said that, solar water geysers didn't make financial sense. If you didn't do the arithmetic on the back of a cigarette box 18 months or 2 years ago, it didn't stack up. The price of our energy was just too cheap. With the subsequent increases, it's now starting to become more relevant. And I think as it becomes more relevant, so you will see that pickup starting to take place where it actually, this is the behavioral economics that I speak about. Internationally, you actually have products like a green bond where an added value is given to a property because it's been greened. That hasn't happened in South Africa as yet. You know, the cost of our primary housing is about 34% higher than our resale market. Our developers are really struggling to actually compete at this point in time. Now, I think it's, you know, we've been talking about it all night, about a marketing industry that's going to develop. It's going to happen. And it's a process that is starting. You know,
one of our banks has actually run two innovation projects, and the NHBRC has now taken over that one innovation project around renewables and around alternative technology. And NHBRC are now using it as their testing ground. So that momentum is gathering. It's not there yet. The question around can I take an access bond to retrofit a property, you certainly can, as long as you've got the equity in the property. And that's the issue, and as long as you can afford it. But that's not the solution. Then you need bigger solutions, and you're right in saying what you say. The second question, which came from DTI around local content, I do agree with what Vank is saying. You know, the problem with South Africa, we're in our infancy. If you look at international products, they've got this longevity in terms of track record, and they've rolled it out on a critical brand basis for many, many years. And as a lender, if I'm going to lend long, I need to have reliability of product, and I need to have substitute. If that product does break, then I can actually substitute it. If I don't have that, it does at risk for me. That's not the solution, though. That's why the NDR are facilitating that project that we're busy with, to see how we can bring DBSA and RDC into the same forum where we can actually start sharing bits and pieces that we can actually work through the problem that you described. There was a third question around SMEs. SMEs, by their very nature, does pose a higher risk to a lender than established businesses. You know, it's not just about balance sheet, it's about capacity, it's about skills, etc. I think there is the need for a toolkit. I think there is the need for us to try work to see, certainly in the smaller space, and the speaker from Senate broke it up into boxes the other night, the big projects and the little guys. And I think we need to look at those little guys and see how the SMEs can actually play a role in that space. There are some risk enhancers that have been put in place over the years by the state, and we need to see how we can perhaps tailor some of those as part of our project that we're busy with to see if we can't get SMEs more involved. Startups are a problem. They are much higher risk for a lender than an established business, I must be very honest with you, and a lender would rather lend to an established company, but we need...
By that time, incentives then come in to compensate, you know, or to mitigate that. Something that, like, you know, I'm talking, looking at TI, SAS, energy, ITC and things, you know. That's not that they respond now, but also even to you. Surely, as a company in such a mature industry, one would have assumed a proactive initiative from the side to, you know, knock at the door of TI or wherever, said, look, is there a way of restructuring a certain incentive to accommodate this bottleneck? Because we're talking of, at least the initial phase, 112 billion rents, you know, investment. Surely, you know, let alone the subsequent phases. Sorry, I'm just deliberately provocative. That what about incentives? You know, let us have even a new one. Maybe there's an existing one. We can just be varied, you know, here and there. Maybe there's a sub-incentive within the regime of incentives that exist.
I think you're right, Chair. We will certainly address it in our project. I think it's a very worthwhile course.
Today I don't see hands shooting up like the last time. I don't see it today. Was that one? Two at the back, three the Navy, Jersey. Four at the back again. Okay? No one? Don't forget to introduce yourself and where you come from.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Terry Kruger. I represent Juvia Renewable Energies. This is more of a comment, actually, and maybe just a different perspective. I, for years, have worked with Department of Energy, and as Ukun would know, on the problem of parroting and the issue how it kills our children and destroys a lot of homes and communities. And in fact, I was part of the Central Energy Fund, GTZ, commission to look at pilot projects with the Department of Energy. I chaired the technical committee with SAB for years to change the instruments, the stoves, to try and prevent this problem, which was actually in 2003, Treasury calculated that it cost our economy 104 billion rand per year in reacting to the problem. I was there when SAB actually made the regulation on low non-precious stoves, which unfortunately was never really enforced. There was no real capacity to enforce the situation, so the situation continued. After years of much lobbying, winning national science and engineering and technology awards, consumer champion awards, it was a frustration that there was still a lot of talk and little action. I jumped ship, joined the renewable energy sector, because I honestly believe that the true solution is by bringing clean energy to the people, and especially as Mr. Beer was saying, that you can take renewables and why not enable municipalities to be able to buy renewables and actually produce solutions where they need it. And as Honourable Galen was saying, you know, we really need to try and find innovative solutions in areas where there is no good connectivity and all this havoc is carrying on. So honestly, when I hear people talk about the cost of renewables, and yes, it is comparatively expensive when you look at coal and the others, what are the costs of the lives and the loss of productivity and all the other areas that we are not considering as well? So as our colleague from the banking industry was saying, I think there's time for less talk, more implementation. There's a lot of enthusiasm, there's a lot of interest, there's a lot of proven technologies out there. Let's get on and actually make it happen. Thank you.
Michael?
My name is Vito Schnabel, representing Kendo Technologies Renewables, and being in the field of SMMEs, and I can just thank the other colleague here that's pounding of that. I just want to put it into perspective. We're spending for the first two bid rounds 100 billion of rand, and we're creating very, very few real jobs. And my question is, do the industry to really take these things in two parts? One is the big producers and the issues that are on that, and the other thing is create an industry with MMEs around renewable energy, especially in the rural areas, especially in small environments. And then thirdly, the other point that I want to do, South Africa has got the tendency to reinvent the wheel with all the testing and certification. There are many, many certification testing agencies out there in the world that have tested products all over the place. But no, we have to reinvent that and retest. Why can't we accept tests that's been done by European testing organizations like TÜV or whoever they are that have done these kind of tests before and just get on with it, get these products in the market and let's get on with it. Net metering is a typical example of that. Now we're talking about what net metering devices we need to get, testing them, all of that. It's going to be another year or two until we get this approved. So my request is also less talk, more doing. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean.
Number three.
It's Justin Burnett from Obelisk Energy. I also sort of pick up on the point of there are lots of existing technologies that are certified who would like to be here, who are looking for a bit more market certainty. We've heard those words often tonight, so I just want to underline it. Particularly in the large project space, we'll see some of that market certainty occur as financial close happens on the first few rounds of projects. But I think what we're missing is what happens beyond the REAP. And I think if there's more market certainty given for the next, say, 10 years, 5 to 10 years, I think that might be the most effective way of actually financing more local manufacturing. On the products that don't exist already, what we're really talking about is local innovation. And what we don't see a lot of is seed capital. We can't really ask the banks to fund startup companies. That's not normally the role to fill. We need more seed capital and more programs aimed at
seed
capital.
Oh, seed capital, okay.
And with rules around them that are less that encourage innovation and are less concerned about payback, but actually encourage experimentation and innovation. And finally, it's a question. We've got a number, and it's for the DOE, we've got a number of different programs for the funding of products and projects and assets. But as the renewable industry grows, we'll see a number of services that need to emerge to support those products. I don't see a lot of programs available for the building up of service companies that are going to have to invest in training and building up staff before there's any revenue to be earned. All those on the cards. Thank you.
Minister, I like your last point, very, very fundamental, that we cannot be singular in our focus. We've got to be multi-pronged and look at all aspects of the industry. Okay, number four.
Good evening, Chairman Theo Lotter. I represent the Axom Group, currently the largest manufacturer of electrical and mechanical equipment in South Africa. We have 42 manufacturing facilities in the country, employ close to 8,000 people today. This state of fact again that we've been tendering and quoting for the last couple of years, not a single order in place. So just some feedback from the industry, and we're trying very hard to keep our companies and their CEOs motivated and committed and capacity available, but it's becoming tough to do that. We've got to get the show on the road. It's got to move now. It has reached the point. I think we've heard it a few times. So that feedback from us. Secondly, on local content, I think let's look at stuff on local content. The way we see it, from an industry point of view, it's about job creation. And just something to think about, and I think the tools already exist. Rather than to, there is a place for new businesses, and we ourselves are engaged in several and many enterprise development projects, and we do that, and they're available. You can go and welcome to look at the website, all listed there. And I think that is a safe way to get small businesses going with support from beyond. But we think on localization, focus on those things that add jobs. And there are many innovative ways of adding value on paper and then claiming that as a local concept. Let's see where we can create more jobs. And it's a lot easier to expand an existing successful business and add a lot more jobs that way and quicker. And one thought I need to leave you with is let's look at the offset system of making components that we're already good at, that we can do, the facilities exist, and export them to the OEMs who come to the country, rather than to try and make everything for everybody. It's just not practical. It's not going to happen. I think that is an important aspect. Again, feedback from the industry. Some of our factories are 100 years old. We've been manufacturing for 100 years, and I've got it to take up and something to our banking colleague over there. We vehemently object to the statement made at one of the banks at the conference. We invited that bank to come and speak to us, including that person. He didn't pitch up. Okay? It's unacceptable to make statements that South Africa, I think that I made locally, is not bankable. I mean, that is just unacceptable to us as an industry. It's not true. There are very good businesses existing, have been there for 100 years, and let's not forget that. And I think, we must be very careful to make sweeping statements, and it has a huge negative effect on the people who are there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fenton?
Chair, I'd just like to go back to the common part of now about service. In my presentation, I spoke about looking at the full value chain. That you don't necessarily have to focus on the front end and the manufacturer, core manufacturer side. There's also the installation and the maintenance and ongoing servicing. And I think therein lies a huge opportunity for job creation and a core competency. Some months ago, I had a chat to the association that is responsible for installing solar water geysers. We don't have sufficient our regulations say you have to have a qualified electrician to actually install that solar water heater. We don't have a lot of it. Now, for me, that's a relatively simple, low-hanging fruit there where we can create jobs with very little effort. But we need to put our money behind it because the people that are involved in that area, the only training that they could get was during the week, during the day, that they were forfeiting their pay at the office. So we need to be a little bit innovative and think a little bit about the servicing and installation side. I think it's a huge opportunity there without too much effort.
I do see.
I just want to respond to the point made about C Capital for Innovation. The special program for industrial innovation is a government incentive. It sits within the IDC. It's not part of the IDC, but we manage the process, so that is available for funding innovation and projects. The IDC also has a venture capital unit, which funds seed capital for technology that can be patented. They do take equity in the company, and they fund it up to commercialization stage. bearing in mind that there are certain parameters involved on the nature of the technology, just in terms of its ability to be commercialized. And I think the aim of both those funds is to address exactly what you're saying, so that we can become leaders in technology and not just responsible manufacturers. On the point of seed capital, and I think it links somewhat to the point of SME development, I think the risk to financiers is it's a little bit ugly to just focus on the lack of finance. It's the reason the risk on the financial side is high is because the marketing risk is very high. It's about accessibility to existing corporates. And not many buyers of any services or products are very keen to listen to upstarts with no track record. If that was addressed, it would be a lot easier for financiers to step in. And legislation on the newest BE, broad-based BE scorecard, I think has gone a long way by introducing the enterprise development angle to that. And that promotes access for new companies, and thereafter the financier can step in to support it. Also on the triple BE scorecard is money spent on skills development, which speaks to what you mentioned about the availability of necessary skills. And that is something else that was designed by the state to promote skills development. One of our clients at the IDC has taken an indirect equity stake in has set up a training center for solar water users because he needed the necessary skills, and that's working out very well. It's self-motivated by his need to get his product rolled out into the market. And that's a good example of a company, I think, that has graduated from an SME to a larger corporation. One of the challenges with SMEs is they enter without a track record or financial backing, but expect to play at a higher level than might be appropriate. So SME development is best based on a model that starts very small, proves their technical ability, accesses the available market, before wanting to play in a space where it might not be capable of doing. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chamaya is a member of the committee. I want to ask a subjective personal question here. If you were inviting us for dinner, I would ask for somebody. I have installed this solar gear at my home. When the artisan was putting it in, said, it does not relate to temperature. As long as sun rays goes through, your solar is going to hit that water. In the last 3 weeks in Kingston, it was very cold. I thought I would never sit on my geyser, my electric one. I would only use solar. To my surprise, I had to literally switch on my electric geyser, otherwise the water is cold. Is there something wrong with the address that went home? Is there?
One problem, I trust and hope we're rounding up and closing now. Someone will help you. Ladies and gentlemen, I think let's round up now. I think we're back to square one, like in the first energy stakeholders meeting, where a lot of issues were raised in so much that it gets difficult to even give a summary. But concluding, I would like us to raise once again, I trust and hope we don't have the unfortunate experience that we got with them. One electronic company in Atlantis. I'm just trying to get the name. No, it's not really. I don't know which other one. I was still in the portfolio coming for trade and industry. We did a visit there, and we found that the company had brilliant ideas to create jobs for skilling the local youth, but they were about to close. And at the time, the Department of Trade and Industry, Trade Minister Robert himself, he literally went there. There was no turning back. I'm referring here to TI, IDC, to Fungo Fungo. Surely something can be explored there. Because we are under spotlight amongst the pioneering countries on renewable energy in the world. Can I suggest a few things? One, let us invite further inputs. I'm sure we've just got Mr. Kose, the Community Secretary, conduct, particularly the image, because as a matter of practice, we want to take everything that has been presented here, mold it into a set of recommendations, and through the Speaker's office, submit it to the executive, precisely to the Department of Energy, formally. Today, out of this engagement, these are the recommendations that come from the committee. Please consider it.
the thousands, various corners of the state works. However, I would strongly recommend here, right here now, that SADC intensively engages with the banking association and whoever else. And surely they would use the communication or the network to respond and, you know, whatever indicate the outcomes of that. But on the other hand, the development funds institutions should be lined up as well. Your IDCs, NEF, and the provincial, actually, you know, the cause and provincial IDCs, West, RAW, ECDC, FTC, JEDA, and others. I think they should be brought in, even if their funding amounts are less. But, I mean, I don't know the figures, but some of the, you know, procurement requirements are about 5 megawatts, which I'm sure the funding requirements get less and less, I suppose. But if not, you know, where there's a will, there's a way to, as I say, create new products as much as, you know, we expect, you know, new incentives or refined incentives to be created, you know, to address the bottlenecks. And SADC should really robustly engage with the Bureau of Standards and NRC. I know provincialization would be difficult because you shoot up the cost, but, you know, once again, SADC and the NRCS, remember, I mean, at the end of the day, in total, how much will this industry be generating if the first phase is just 100 billion on its own? Surely some engagement is quite essential there. But really, the gentleman over there said a couple of very, very good areas, you know, that let us creatively add value, you know. But obviously, opportunity cost and, you know, the competitive analysis is also important, you know, to see. But products can be locally manufactured, which ones cannot be. You people know better, but from our side, you know, I must also be honest, Prof, my expectation was to have heard that people saying that we have tried like that for a couple of meetings, but nothing came through. But one doesn't hear that. And so I wanted to say that, look, well, please get on. Even if a couple of meetings are a torturous path we have to go through, that's part of acting. There's another engagement very necessary. We give to Dr. De Beers input, you know, because every area has got to create or contribute to creating a creation of a conducive environment. SADC has got to engage for rural energy, if I can call it, off-grid. Another friend has already gone. And also the engagement with municipalities. They've got to engage with the National Treasury, the Department of Energy. I don't know the ESCOM would come in. And even SALGA, and to look at if there's a way of wavering the blockages in MSMA, you know. But also the I'm sorry, this to the industry, not just the SADC, but the whole of the manufacturing industry, which may have to play a role one way or another in other areas, that we've been provoked today to think seriously about the ancillary industries, the way of adding value. I think that's what we're saying. Skills. I'm glad Professor Vinayak Panika from Stellenbosch is not around, because he would throw us into a corner and say, what the heck has said, Mr. Levinson. He said so. He did it in the first meeting that the government is not doing enough to look at skills development. And sitting here, my expectation is an assumption that as we venture into this field, if there's a need of some special skills development, you know, maybe you're very electrical technicians, if they need to have some additional skills by now, sorry, but there should have some intensive engagement with FH colleges as the first point of call. That's off the cuff. There could be other. Already, he said there's another company that just decided to do its own training, you know, and the services. It may not be creating that much of many jobs, but it has you know, a ripple effect in ensuring that this emerging industry grows, because there's no industry that grows. It's like a millipede or an octopus. It grows because of all its left functioning and coordinating, you know. Yes, we all do a sense that we can sense when you put on turbines, the construction period creates a rupture, but thereafter, it's maintenance. All everything drops, but where do we see the job creation in this area? It's manufacturing, you know. But there are ancillary fitting in industries, which have just has to be as good as and almost perfect in order to ensure that that strengthens. And remember, at the end of the day, one of the strongest drives by this government through GTI is to revive our manufacturing capacity. You know, not just back to its glory, former glory, but even beyond, particularly with the infrastructure plan on the way, with all its coming, with all its offering. Ladies and gentlemen, once again we overshoot, we have overshot the closing time. Thanks for the stamina. And once again, maybe as a parting shot, last one. You're not inhibited in throwing in an idea for future energy studying stakeholders meetings. At the beginning of the year, we had a nice list of items of topics. But as time goes on, we look at a very pertinent topic and bring, and as you can see, those who have been here before, it always attracts people, because all we're doing is to create a platform for people to engage, present their concerns or even ideas or suggestions. And I'm sure from the department itself and the department, not only one, and the state-owned enterprises, they are quite responsive. They've been taking copious notes, and without telling you, they will see how they consider them in their daily jobs, you know, when, you know, back at work. And the same thing will happen to us, because we will not leave things to chance, no matter how slow we can be, if they can prepare with us, but we will make sure that we value and capture and process the inputs that come here. By that, let's call it a night. See you next time.